And what did happen?
Okay. You see, we did crash. It was on this crazy island. And we waited for rescue, and there wasn't a rescue. And then there was a smoke monster. And then there were other people on the island. We called them the Others. And they started attacking us. And we found some hatches, and there was a button you had to push every 180 minutes, or... Well, I was never really clear on that. But the Others didn't have anything to do with the hatches. That was the Dharma Initiative. They were all dead. The Others killed them. And now they're trying to kill us. And then we teamed up with the Others because some worse people were coming on a freighter. Desmond's girlfriend's father sent them to kill us. So we stole their helicopter and we flew it to their freighter, but it blew up. And we couldn't go back to the island because it disappeared. So then we crashed in the ocean and we floated there for a while until a boat came and picked us up. And by then there were six of us. That part was true.
I came on a plane.
What plane?
A Jira Flight 316. And that's how I returned to the island.
So, why him?
What was it that was so wrong with me? What about me?
What about you?
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast for Season 6, Episode 15, Across the Sea. And if you had to hide the light in your hometown, where is it? My name's Dave Gonzalez, and I'm putting the light in the drainage pipe under South Boulder Road in Louisville, Colorado.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and I forgot to write down an answer for this, but I grew up in Mill Valley, California. So my temptation is to put it under the original mill that gave the title of the town Mill Valley. Or There's a place called Three Wells, which is, we used to play in as kids, which is like a waterfalls cascading into three separate pools. That seems very like golden lighty. So maybe Three Wells in Mill Valley, California.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I would put it, there aren't really good landmarks in my hometown. It's like a suburb with a mall, but there was a very crappy patch of woods near Pine Elementary School in North Olmsted, Ohio, where I grew up. And, it's the woods that I walked through to get to school every day, and no one was ever there except that one time I tried cigarettes for the first time and didn't like it. So yeah, I think it's a very like inauspicious place to put the light, and no one would ever find it there.
You got to keep it secret. You got to keep it safe. Maybe you could do a little bit of that itself, considering it's, you know, here on an island that we've seen a lot of. Who knows? We're going to discuss it in this week's podcast. If this is your first time joining us, weird choice, bro. But all right. Maybe you're doing a chronological rewatch. I don't know. This podcast is an ideal companion if you're rewatching the ABC series Lost with us or visiting the island for the very first time. That's because each episode comes in sections for your listening pleasure. First, there's a calm section that only discusses the preceding episodes and avoids all spoilers. And then there's a second section called The Storm. It's a storm of spoilers discussing this week's episode in the context of the entire series and over a decade of Lost fandom. If you look down at your podcasting device, you'll see estimated time codes where each of these sections start. Don't worry about skipping into the storm. There's a sound cue at the beginning. It's going to be perfectly fine. For the final season of Lost, or the final couple of episodes, we've shifted to releasing the podcast on Saturday evening in the U.S. after our group live watch in our Storm Slack. How do you join us for the big ending, do you ask? Why, you go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers. There you will find ways to subscribe to us for a monthly fee, and depending on what level you choose, you get more and more bonus content. And when you subscribe for the first time, you get instant access to all the other bonus content we've made while being The Storm. It's like interview bits, bonus podcasts, various oddities. There's more stuff being added to that gigantic pile each week. And there are more watch-alongs in our Storm Slack for our patreon.com/stormofspoilers members. Like Joanna is watching some Marvel movies.
It's true. Kristen Russo and I are watching some Marvel tonight. After we finish recording this podcast, but it will be too late for you to join. We're watching Winter Soldier, my favorite Marvel movie, but we're also watching Civil War and we're watching The Ragnarok over the next couple weeks for our Feels Like the First Time podcast. If you're a subscriber, you can hear Chris and me talking about Marvel on Feels Like the First Time, and you'll find I gave Chris a pop quiz as to what she thought the superpowers were of various Avengers, and my favorite, I think, had to be Falcon, where she said it like captured people with his giant mouth or something like that. Oh. Sorry. Anyway, so yeah, that's something that's going on. And also, should we mention that we have a special guest on the podcast this week?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we have a special guest on the podcast this week.
Chief TV critic from Rolling Stone magazine, Alan Sepinwall. Alan had his choice of any final season episode, and he chose this one. So it's a really, we had a really fun chat. Alan and I talked like, I don't know, 2 months ago about this. So I have no recollection of that conversation, really. So hopefully I don't repeat myself too much. But that is something you'll hear in the middle of this podcast, Between the Calm and the Storm. Alan and I talked about Across the Sea. So there you go. You can find out more about what we're up to at stormpodcast.com. You can follow us on Twitter at stormpodcast. You can email us, host at stormpodcast.com. We got a bunch of emails. We got emails rolling in right now about like where people were for the finale watch, including like photos of their Dharma cakes and stuff like that. It's all really great stuff.
Dharma cakes.
Yeah. You know you want a Dharma cake. So let's read a couple emails. I don't think I did as well, as good of a job as I usually try to do to read everything this week, but, oh yeah, I like this one, from Heather, who said, "Hi, I was 17 when Lost premiered, but never watched it until my roommate's boyfriend wanted to watch Across the Sea with us. We spent the entire episode asking things like, Allison Janney's in the show, and really, it's a Cork Island?" He had no answers and was more confused than us. I didn't plan on watching another episode, but then came my Iraq deployment. I was a night shift hospital medic, bored out of my mind, and wanted something to keep me awake, so Lost. I binged it all in 2 weeks of 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. shifts, and remembered almost nothing except Jin and Saeed's hotness. I spent the last 3 months of deployment binging Reba and Big Bang Theory, so Lost definitely did something to my brain. Watching Lost again in another situation where you can't go anywhere for safety reasons, can only communicate with loved ones online, and extreme feelings of isolation is some time as a flat circle weirdness. Thanks for making me revisit Lost and all your hard work, Heather. So, Heather first watched Across the Sea. What a way.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a way to go.
Started at the very beginning.
Yeah, I guess she started with chronological Lost.
Yeah, chronological. Then skip to season 5.
And then we've got an email from Haley, who writes in. She just watched. She said, "I decided on a whim a few weeks ago to give Lost a try when I saw it on Hulu. I had always avoided it as hard as." As I heard it had a bad ending, but seeing that it had 6 seasons, I figured I'd get bored and drop off before it got to the timey-wimey stuff that I've heard so many people complain about. Man, was I wrong. I'm hooked, and naturally I searched for a companion podcast to help me unpack. It's an awesome show, and I'm so happy to find yours. Man, I wish I had found this pod during its Game of Thrones days. I finally caught up with the podcast, and I watched The Candidate last night. Full disclosure, when I started watching this series, I Googled to see who survived or the original cast so that I wouldn't be disappointed by the death. So that said, I knew that Saeed, Sun, and Jin would all die by the end of the show, but I didn't know how or when. Man, was I shook to see them all go out like that in a matter of a few minutes. Aside from the problems you already discussed with killing off most of our remaining POC characters in one fell swoop, I actually found Sun and Jin's death to be the most emotionally impactful since Boone died in season 1. I'm a big crier, and when Boone died, I boohoo sobbed and just thought to myself, man, this show's going to be rough for me since almost all these people die. But I actually didn't have that emotional response to most of the following deaths. Some made me mad like echoes, and I was horrified and shocked when I thought Jin perished in the freighter explosion. But there was no more sobbing. And sorry to say, I never really fully bought into Juliet and Sawyer, so that goodbye did not land for me.
Whoa.
Then came this episode. Mm. I was relieved by the way that Saeed went out. I knew he was going to die, so I'm sure that helped my acceptance of this a lot. But with the dark path they put him on the season, I was honestly so relieved that he got a Charlie-style self-sacrificing death rather than going out as a different person than the one we came to know and love. Um. Yeah, and then she talks, sorry, it's a long email, so she talks about losing it when Sun and Jin died. After sitting with the episode a bit, I think my biggest complaint is putting these two death scenes so close together. They shouldn't have been in the same episode even. And on that, we agree. So Haley's point is that maybe we wouldn't be so mad about Sun and Jin if it came at a different time. What do you guys think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think we talked about this last week. It's like, you probably could successfully kill off these three characters if you had placed the deaths elsewhere. It still wouldn't have been great, but the timing of it feels like they rushed to get a lot of stuff in right before we hit the big finale, right? I mean, we'll talk about it with this week's episode.
Yeah.
But it's we got to kill all these characters real quick.
Yeah, because it could have, like, they had a whole early sixth season we were dicking around
at the temple.
Really enjoy.
The temple.
Yeah.
And then this email comes from Beth, a longtime listener, active participant in our Slack. And Beth writes in to say, I've been meaning to write a more comprehensive look at the ableism in Lost, particularly around the character of John Locke, but we're running out of time, so I wanted to offer something more brief. Throughout the series, including in The Sideways, John's paralysis and use of a wheelchair is consistently portrayed as a burden, whether it's the walkabout leader telling him he can't go on the trip, or in the physical therapist in Man from Tallahassee puts him in the wheelchair for the first time and he cries over his condition. During his wheelchair years, Locke constantly demeans himself, even when other people like Abaddon rightly point out that it's a miracle he survived after Anthony Cooper pushed him out of a window. Once his legs regain mobility on the island, he lives in constant fear of disability, and look at the number of times his legs are damaged throughout the series. Locke comes to believe he's special on the island because it heals his paralysis, even though it also healed Rose's cancer, and she doesn't become obsessed with her destiny as a result. And Locke's blind faith brings harm and even death to those around him, including Boone, Echo, and ultimately himself. In the main storyline, Locke's disability and his feelings about his disability are a proxy for how he feels about his father's betrayal, and in The Sideways, he accepts it as a punishment for the plane crash he and his father were in. But disability isn't a punishment, and it isn't a betrayal. Disability is a neutral condition, one that almost all of us will experience in some form at some time in our lives. Lost is known for trying to increase representation and dispel stereotypes about different kinds of people. But with Locke's disability, they pretty much perpetuated old ideas about disability. It's one of the biggest disappointments of this rewatch. Thanks for everything, Beth. Dave, any thoughts?
I agree with what you said about defining disability, but it's like we don't ever, you know, get to see like a really, really old man Locke, but that old man Locke would be mad at everything because Locke's mad at the thing that's telling him what he can't do. And in this case, it's his own body, which he views as a betrayal, which obviously, as Beth outlined, it's not. But I do feel like it's the reason it's not maybe treated with fully is, I think, if you were to break him down to like his core character needs, it would be more about he doesn't want to be limited, period, in this island, either through like hunting knowledge or anything of the sort, being able to walk around, being able to lead people in the correct direction. He just doesn't want to be limited in that way. So I think if the series does make an oversight and maybe throw some shade on disabilities, it's through something that feels true to a character for me, so it doesn't feel as malicious as it could. But maybe that's part of the problem, is I'm used to that sort of narrative. So it's hard for me to say at this point.
Yeah. I think it's a fair criticism for sure, of the show. And, you know, Lost did for a long time want to be known as a show that, you know, pushed representation forward. And this is an area where they probably could have done better. I do also think that it would have been a very different ride for the character of John Locke if he had been able to sort of, have a healthier relationship or with his disability, or have a, you know, healthier, processing of that. Like Dave said, it is one of the things that drives a lot of John Locke's narrative, especially on the island. But I think that his issues with his disability are rooted in some deeper character things that the show does, you know, to its credit, explore a lot of that, you know.
This reminds me of when we talked about some of the, like, disordered eating, body image stuff with Harley, where it's like, I there are moments of the way, because I don't think Lost treated this topic thoughtlessly. And I think there are some really beautiful moments around this, like when John is like sitting on the plane and has to wait to be helped. That loss of control he feels, all of that. I think it's really well done. I think Terry O'Quinn's performance is beautiful, all of that sort of stuff. But when it comes to this is why representation matters, when it comes to there only being one character dealing with this, and that one character's experience then has to carry the weight
for everyone,
you know what I mean? So like, it makes sense to me that John Locke would have all the emotions that he has around this because of what both of you just said about his personality. But like, and if there was someone else on this show who didn't have that relationship with their disability, then
you need to give him his Jason Street murder ball league.
Herc needs to show up to teach him how to play murder ball. Yeah. So it's fun fact, Herc was in the Dharma Initiative anyway. I agree with a lot of what Beth has to say, but I also think it's even more complicated than that. Do you know what I mean? So, which is what she said. She wanted to send us a longer email. She sent us a shorter one because we're running out of time. But I think there's a little bit of nuance there. And I will say that like one of my favorite episodes or moments in The Flash Sideways is when Locke is like frustrated with Helen because he feels like she's trying to push the surgery. And he's just sort of like, if this is who I am, and if this isn't enough for you, like, we should end it right here. And she's like, no, this is what I just want you. You know what I mean? So, like, I think that's a really, it's not the end of that story in The Flash Sideways, unfortunately, but, like, I think that's a really beautiful moment of, like, stop trying to fix me, this is who I am sort of thing. Do you know?
So. Yep.
All right, and then I have one more email, and then we can dive into our proper episode discussion of this wild episode. Okay, this is from Jeremy, who writes, based on your conversation about Lost 2 during The Candidate, I have three questions for the pod. Number one, what do you think the chances are that Malcolm David Kelly would come back to play Walt for Lost 2? Two, if possible, can you think of actors you would cast to play the various children? If it's easier to just say that kid from insert show / movie here, that's okay too. We have Clementine, Charlie Hume, Jeon, and Aaron. I'm probably missing someone. I feel like, did we try this before? And I was like, I don't know who the Utes are.
I don't know who the Utes are.
Definitely not that Justin Bieber looking kid they got. No, I actually really like the kid who plays the young man in black. He just has Bieber Efron hair, which is wild. Sure.
He visited the Lost wig department. And it went poorly. It's a real crapshoot over there.
And they gave him 2008 hair, whatever this was. Mm-hmm.
Well, Malcolm David Kelly is still a working actor, so of course you'd want him back if he was up for it.
So how old do these kids have to be?
Well, they can be any age.
But no, they can't.
Oh gosh,
no, what? No, they can't.
Well, not like specific kids, ages, kid, but like, you know, like they so could they, be like in their 20s like... or.
The 10 years since the show went off the air, or like,
well, see, the thing is, Lost has specific dates for these children's birth, right? True. Or at least like time periods and years. Mm-hmm. So, like, if we just wait, we could hire not Utes, like, I don't know, teens,
late teens, okay. Early 20s.
Well, I think we're already in teens, right? If we have people who watch this show when they were like 11.
Okay, so Charlie is born in 2005. Charlie Hume is born in 2005.
So he'd be about 16.
Lostpedia. So he's 16.
Oh, yeah. This is great. This is like a bunch of like multi-ethnic Peter Parkers. Yes. Yeah. Fantastic.
Hotties with the bodies. No, they're children. I mean, like fun, cool kids. but we can hook them because they can be. Clementine is going to be a little older. I think she's going to be like 18 or something like that, right?
Yeah. And that's a pretty wide berth where you like you could look much older than that or much younger than that if we wanted to. I think it's hard to cast at this point because I don't really know what the specifics of them are, but
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of okay admitting that I don't really know any teen actors by name at the moment. Like, I don't really know who the
I'm gonna think about
are.
It, and I would appreciate some emails from people, and I will try to think about it. I mean, I know the Stranger Things kids.
Sure.
I know the Fear Street kids.
So
I know some
yeah,
of the
so
Spider-Man
We're gonna get what's her name from Stranger Things, and she's gonna play a character. She didn't even have to play. What's that actress's name?
Are you talking about Millie Bobby Brown?
Yeah, Millie Bobby Brown.
Okay.
She doesn't even have to play one of the characters. We just need her in the show so that the suits will sign off.
I think we're legally obliged to cast McKenna Grace, who has played the young version of every single woman in every single film and TV show in the last couple of years.
Sure. Yeah.
Jacob Tremblay.
Sure.
Can we get? We could round the Luca cast out and get Jack Dylan Grazer as well. Jack Dylan Grazer has good Charlie Hume hair, I have to say.
All right.
So, you know, there's some good options here. I reject Millie Bobby Brown in our Lost 2.
Okay, that's fair.
Well, I don't know if we want to reject people this early out. What if we need a weird Dharma person? And
oh, yeah, sure.
Millie Bobby Brown.
Yeah.
And not as a lead. Okay, Joanna, fine.
Yeah.
You could have up or down on leads for sure.
Thanks for that.
Yeah.
But if we're going to have a sweeping Lost 2, we got to take all television comers and make an old-fashioned that guy series.
I just think our writer's room, our executive producer's room is just so incredibly functional and would work out super well, so we'd figure it out.
Yeah, everybody knows in order to be a critic, you have to know everything about doing something,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I really am going to think about this, Jeremy, and I'm going to try to come up with a killer cast.
Sure.
The better it is, the less likely you'll ever hear about it, because we'll just quietly go off and try to develop it.
Mm-hmm.
Jeremy says, also, my third question is really more of a storm prompt by itself, but it ties in the last two. We're going to put that in the storm. Okay, as he said. All right, carry on. So my question for you, Neil, is what in the blazes happened on Lost this week?
What an incredible task I've been given. It's almost like I've been put in charge of an island of mystery myself to do this intro. This episode, Across the Sea, was written by Carlton Cuse and Damon Lindelof and directed by Tucker Gates, all names you've heard before. It aired on May 11th, 2010, and it takes place on the island. We begin several thousand years in the past. We watch as a young pregnant woman named Claudia washes up on the beach after a shipwreck. There, she meets a mysterious woman, played by Allison Janney, and soon gives birth to two boys, Jacob and his nameless brother. But before she can meet her sons, Claudia is murdered horrifically with a rock. This murderous other mother tries to raise the boys to be wary of people and protective of the island, especially the part of the island that is a light cave, which we will get to. But things change when Claudia's ghost appears to Jacob's brother and hits him with a little bit of the truth. The ensuing existential crisis breaks this family apart and sets the brother off on a quest to discover a way off the island. After flashing forward to 30 years later, we see that, with the help of the other survivors from Claudia's ship, the brother eventually does find a solution that to get off the island. That involves magnetism, a well, and a donkey wheel, all of which are very familiar to us at this point. Upon hearing of this development, the other mother shows up to murder everyone, then immediately hands over stewardship of the island to Jacob by giving him some river water to drink. Having survived the attack somehow, the brother returns to the caves where he was raised, and he murders the mother, and oddly enough, she seems kind of relieved. We'll unpack that. Moments later, Jacob arrives to discover the scene, and fueled by rage, he takes revenge by throwing his brother into the mysterious light cave. The cave, which is described as the heart of the island, then births the smoke monster before also spitting out the brother's dead body, leaving Jacob alone to clean up the mess. The whole thing ends with Jacob laying his other mother and his brother to rest in the island caves, where our Flight 815 survivors will discover them centuries later. It turns out that Adam and Eve were really the man in black and the adopted mother that he murdered. Fun fact about this episode. I have two, actually. For the only time in the show's run, in this, its 118th hour of television, no main cast members appear in original footage. Everything is reused footage from previous episodes. The only new stuff is, obviously, the Man in Black and Jacob stuff. It's also only the second episode of the series to present the story, the episode story, in chronological order, along with the other 48 days, which we'll remember. This week's opening question, one of Lost's great unanswered mysteries, I guess, which is, how did the mother get to the island? We'll start there. How do you think that the mother, Allison Janney's character, got to the island? Or do you think she was there from the beginning? Let's start this week with Joanna.
What do you mean by beginning?
I don't know, like the beginning of existence?
I've always been here. I mean, so something, I guess this is a little stormy.
Is the mother God, or what's going on?
Something we should say to our listeners, even the commies, we will never find out. If you think you're going to get more information about the mother, you are wrong. I think she's been there a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of like how Jacob is like ready to retire. She's sure. ready to retire is why she's actively recruiting successors.
Yeah. Dave, what do you think?
Let's do an old Citadel of Crazy Town here. Right? Let's say she wandered into the light source in ancient Mesopotamia. And the island drift off and started moving.
Wow.
And then she was just on it.
I think my theory on this is that, like Joanna said, she's probably been there a long, long time. But the fact that she sort of clearly understands what the rules are for passing along the success, like she knows the little chant, she knows that she's got to give him the water. It tells me that someone did this to her at some point, right? So, like, it's kind of like when in the episode where Desmond gets sort of conned into taking over, pushing the button, like all the way back in what, season two?
Mm-hmm.
It's like at some point the mother may have been an actual, like, you know, person that got stranded on this island, and whoever was in charge at the time was like, drink this water, I'm out of here, goodbye. And she's been stuck there ever since.
Okay.
Stuck there ever since.
But okay, follow question. Why does she sound like she's from the Midwest?
I mean, even when she's speaking Latin.
That's a very good question, Joanna.
I guess actually, why does she sound like she's from Boston, Massachusetts? Allison Janney does not. Okay, wait. Raised in Dayton, Ohio. Okay, that makes more sense to me. Okay, why does she sound like she's from Ohio then?
Let's start our calm discussion topic with this one that says Allison Janney stunt casting. What do we think?
Thanks, such a I wild hate choice. It, actually, thanks. I hate it.
I like this actress.
Yes.
Dislike everything about this.
I think she could have been really fun as like a spooky Dharma Initiative like leader or something like that in an earlier season. But as like an ancient woman who's been on this island a really long time and speaks Latin and dresses in like tunics.
Mm-hmm.
No. Yeah. Also, this I think is, it just like sticks out in a big, I mean, Allison Janney then wasn't quite Allison Janney now, but she's still Allison Janney. And like, it's like it lands with a thud, I think, because they don't really, Lost didn't really do stunt casting like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, not only that, but there's no character there. Like, she's there to say some things, and I don't know if it was an acting choice. I don't know if you're jet lagged because you flew to Hawaii for your, you know, single spot. I don't know if the directors just told you that you can't hint in any direction because they're so afraid that people will read into it the wrong way. I don't know what it is, but this performance is just horrible. Like, I don't know what to pull from
it. It definitely feels very zoned out, right? Like, people talk about actors phoning it in. This is more of like a, she was there. But she was just sort of chilling.
Yeah, I mean, no, it's not the script's fault, because, like, I think Titus Welliver is incredible in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Titus Welliver's so good. Mark Pellegrino is also good.
He's at least doing something.
Yeah. And Mark Pellegrino...
Allison Janney is literally, like, what's the most, the strongest emotion? She kills somebody with a rock.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's,
when
like,
she
there's
drives
a...
him against the wall also.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
there's definitely, goes, like... Especially in that first scene, there's a little bit of terror about her. Like, it's there's this cold sort of calmness that ultimately is fairly terrifying when she murders this woman, Claudia. But then there's really not a whole lot else to go on in the rest of the episode. You know, she seems like a very sort of passive character that's along for the ride until she has to throw one of her stolen sons up against a wall next to a donkey wheel.
Well, one of the big frustrating, I mean, Dave, is this one of your least favorite episodes of Lost? How do you feel about it?
No, I actually like it, because it's like a bold swing and a miss.
I actually like it.
Like, if you're going to shoot for the moon, yeah, fucking get past the moon, you know? It's fine.
Can you even
me.
Categorize this one? Like, it's like, last week we talked about, like, obviously one of the worst things Lost has ever done. We've seen so many of the best things that Lost has done. This is the weirdest thing Lost did, and it's not even close.
Big true. The reason I was wondering if maybe Dave hated it is because, like, it centers on a character who will not tell people what's going on. And, like, the main reaction I saw critically from, you know, some of the smart folks who were following Lost is that this felt like an analogy for the show itself, this idea of, like, withholding information. I mean, like, it's just...
Well,
go ahead.
I don't think they're completely off on that, because you're perfectly setting up our official podcast thing, which I think we might as well do now, because this is how they justified it at the time. A little bit long, but it'll be entirely their words. Here we go.
And I think another thing about this episode that you... have said, Carlton, in reference to it, is this is what answers look like on the show. And we've talked about the whole midichlorian thing before on this podcast and other places, but it's been kind of pointed out that maybe we've been misusing the midichlorian metaphor somewhat, because nobody ever asked for the Force to be explained, you know, and people are asking for us to resolve mysteries. But the way that we use the midichlorians is it's the TMI, too much information. It's like suddenly you're answering a question that people don't want you to be answering. And this episode flirts with that idea. If you were cool with Cork, then you didn't need to see across the sea.
Right.
If you weren't cool with Cork, then you needed a further explanation as to exactly what it is about this island that needs to be protected. We went one step further. Maybe we're going to go a couple steps further still. But if you were cool with Cork, you were probably like, really? Light in a cave?
There seems to be some percentage of fans who think that there is, it's possible to sort of kind of hermetically seal this idea of questions. But as Mother says in this episode, every question that I answer will just lead to another question. That is a very purposeful statement on her part. And we kind of view looking at the island...
Almost as if one of us wrote it.
Almost.
As if Mother is not a real person at all.
Almost.
Yeah.
So that's the tone of the final Lost podcast, which is, it seems to be that the show is kind of being meta with that. Like, Mother's telling us that every time you think you're going to have an answer, we're going to throw a light cave at you.
It's interesting that I read a couple interviews that they gave around this time too, which I read some of it to you guys, and they're very prickly and defensive right now. And I understand, because they were anticipating something very scary, and that scary thing happened. You know what I mean? They weren't wrong. But the question is, like, and I think it's a lesson that I think both of them have learned, is this idea of a mystery calibration and how long you can stretch that. And, you know, if you create a mystery show, which this is a mystery show, you are signaling to your audience that they should be looking for answers. But if you mm-hmm. don't intend to give them answers ever, maybe be upfront about that. And that's what, you know, Damon did with The Leftovers. And, like, if you if you want to give them answers, you maybe need to give some answers sooner than all this. And like that brings me to my main point about Across the Sea is here's the two things I would do to fix Across the Sea, which I admire in general. I would put this at the beginning of the season.
Mm-hmm.
And I would not cast Allison Janney. Those are two things I would do. What do you guys think?
Yeah. You either put it at the beginning of the season or it becomes like if they were making Lost nowadays, it would be a series of post-credit scenes that like every week the post-credit scene moved this little story forward until you get to the final reveal of, I guess, the Adam and Eve thing is the big reveal of this episode. I mean, or the, you know, where the smoke monster came from, I suppose. But yeah, where you like you spread it.
Sorry,
out
that was that snark wasn't directed at you. I just find the I find the way the Adam and Eve thing is revealed to be so dumb with the flashback.
You remember those skeletons?
And you're like, remember when Jack had a buzz cut?
Well, and this is a perfect example of answering a question that we didn't necessarily need. Is who are the people in the cave was never. I mean, I guess some people probably asked it, but it didn't feel at the time like a big question that Lost needed to answer. There were so many other mysteries on this island that have happened since that it's like, why did we have to go back and explain the two people in the cave? But, you know, here we are.
I think there are ways in which that could have felt really fun because there are little moments like that where you're like, oh, mm-hmm. And that could be fun. But this, I don't know, maybe because it's just tied to something because like, I think we don't really know why Jacob is arranging their bodies like that. Like, why did he do that? You know, it's just all mm-hmm. kind of like, it all seems engineered towards
the showing us how the donkey wheel came to be installed. That I actually did like. I like that answer because it shows, it gives us more context for the man in black. And that is legitimately one of the weirder things that they've encountered on this island is the donkey wheel that when you spin it, the island moves and you get zapped to Tunisia. Like that is some mystery shit. So I think that's an example of things they did good, but you're right. Like Jacob, very carefully arranging his mother and brother's bodies. And I don't know, just to get the black and white things that they find.
Like, why wouldn't he bury them?
Sure.
You know? I mean,
I guess it's like it's an older story that's supposed to act like the myth of the island, like the origin myth mm-hmm. of Jacob, of whatever we're watching now. But I think like the problem is its touchstones are like MacGuffins in themselves. So like, and that's where this came from, and that's where this came from, where it's like when this sort of thing is done well, when you're able to elevate it, like, I don't know, like say something like the expanded Star Wars universe and that dumb thing George Lucas says about it rhyming. If this was a bunch of emotional beats about emotions that we've seen play out on the island, like if they were splitting up into groups, if they were afraid of the others in a more like recognizable way, I think then this would read slightly to what they were going for. It's just that none of it reads really as emotional except when the adult actors come in and throw their years of television experience at this script that is a lot of exposition, but I don't know that much more about Jacob as a character or the man in black as a character than I did when the episode started.
I disagree. Because sorry.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. Well, it's like the man in black has already told Sawyer that, you know, he had his humanity stolen from him, and he remembers, you know, being human at one point. And so we have that, and to see that happen, it's like, oh, cool, that happened, but I don't know if I felt it, because it comes, like, so suddenly, Jacob is, like, throwing his brother, and his head hits a rock, simply because they, oopsie, already set up the rule they can't hurt each other, so it kind of needs to be, like, an accident. It's just the actual pegs in their ladder of story or whatever don't make any sense to me, and don't have like a huge emotional resonance, which makes them especially pale after, you know, the candidate sort of failed to do the same thing, but at least I had some reaction because I'd been spending so much time with those characters. I don't know. Like, I don't like, I like your idea about putting it at the beginning of the season because I love the WTF of that happening, but also because that would allow us to then see the echoes on the island with the characters that we like.
Yeah. Like,
and then I think the story would have the emotional resonance it's supposed to.
Wouldn't the whole knife thing be cooler when Dogen has it, if we knew what the fuck that knife was?
Yeah. And I mean, I also, go ahead.
Oh no, I was just going to say that I'm very on board with this theory of needing to move it up in the season. I think it definitely should have been the premiere. It also would have, I don't know, softened the blow of that last episode. Cause you know, if you think back to the way people were watching Lost week to week when it was airing, to go from that terrible thing that we talked about last week to an episode where you're telling a completely different story with none of those main characters, it just compounded it. And it would have worked so much better if this episode were out of the way.
Yeah, and that's something we talked about in the storm last week, the fact that like not, it's insult to injury that the submarine thing happens and then this is what follows it. And you know, and imagine watching this in real time and like constantly, okay, now cut back to the present. They're not cutting back. What the fuck? But like, I want to go back to what Dave said about not knowing anything more about Jacob the Man in Black. And I really disagree with that because I think that's the most successful thing this episode does, is it helps me understand Jacob so much more. He's a like freaking mama's boy. Like, I love the reveal of him as this like needy, insecure, like childlike, whatever, and it makes his reign as God like all the more. Who the hell is running the show here? This guy? Like, I think that's incredible. And then I think it adds so much empathy to our understanding of the Man in Black to think of him as this boy who was manipulated and this boy who just wanted to like leave because he was gaslit by this mother figure and all this sort of stuff, like who then slaughtered like all these people. And we have some like hints about, yes, what he said about having his humanity taken from him, but also what he said to Kate earlier in the season about like, my mother was crazy too, something that he said. Don't love that C word, but that's something he said. Or I think he tells Richard, like, I lost someone too. So like the question is like, did he have like a wife or a boyfriend or something like that in that village who died? Like, all of that humanizes him in a way that if they were looking to confuse us for much of the season as to whether or not we should be rooting for the smoke monster, this would have been a helpful element for us to be like, oh, he just wants to get off the island. Like, that's what he's always been trying to do. I kind of support him in that. And then to have it like dovetail into him killing Sun and Jin and Saeed, not to mention all the other people he's killed. I think that would have achieved that reversal that they were looking for. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Titus Welliver is just really good in this episode.
I don't doubt that. He definitely comes out of as the MVP of it. And you know, kind of makes me wish there was a way we could have Terry O'Quinn and Titus Welliver doing both more often.
Yeah, I agree.
That just because, yeah, I don't know, why not? Why not break the story world more for different actors, Lost? You've already done it once. Sorry, go ahead, Neil.
Well, no, I was going to say, one of the other things that's frustrating about the end scene with Jacob is the fact that they then needed to have the Man in Black's body, right? Like, it would have been just fine for Jacob to throw his brother down the well and him come back as the smoke. Like, we get that. The smoke monster can turn into things. But to also have the freaking body there, just, it's weird. It's very weird to me. It's a very weird choice.
Yeah,
an over-answering, for sure.
Well, I think we'll have to talk about it more in the storm, but I think it's there for, like, something else, which is equally as dumb, so don't feel too bad.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Don't feel too bad if you need to... I would sort of write that off because Neil is absolutely correct, and there's nothing that's going to happen in the rest of the series necessarily going to make you feel better if that bothers you. I have an interesting question here, Joanna.
Mm.
Is the mother also a smoke monster?
That's a question I have because it's a common question, not just me. But like, She kills the entire village. Like, how does she get the drop on the entire
village? Fills in the well. Fills in the well. While Titus Welliver is knocked out.
And, like, lifts him out of there. Like, so some of the recaps I read, they were like, Jacob helped her. And I was like, even if Jacob helped her, I think there's something else going on there. So, yeah. Or maybe she was like, you know, because now we have a binary. We have a golden protector in Jacob and a sooty smoke monster in in the Man in Black. And who could have known it would go this way based on their tunics as children? But, But maybe the mother was some, like, hybrid. You know what I mean? Like, a protector and a smoke thing. I don't know.
I agree with this on so many levels.
Yeah. She has some kind of superpower.
But it also makes me feel better that it's her true form isn't Allison Janney.
Like, maybe she did the whole ritual, drank the thing, became the other protector, and then went down to the well, which is what she told Jacob not to do. Because she's like, it's way worse than dying. Don't go down there. Maybe she went down there, and that's why she knows. And maybe that's why she's acting so weird and spooky.
Like, so
maybe she has the sickness. I don't know.
She ends up on the island. She finds the light. She drinks the water. And then she's like, that light, it's the warmest, brightest light I've ever seen. I'm going to go check that out. Bloop, falls in, comes out a smoke monster, is hella confused, and just makes up the rest of the rules.
But I love her power to be like, I've made it so you can't hurt each other. How? Why? Yeah. What? Don't ask questions.
It's there definitely cool. Are like God powers, but then also like, I mean, the thing that also plays into it nicely is if she is both of them, protector and smoke monster, that also means she's trapped, so it plays into her thank you when she finally is like able to die.
Mm-hmm.
Because the thing that separates Jacob from the smoke monster is not only like a power set difference, but Jacob protects and the smoke monster wants to leave.
I mean, the thing that I think is really interesting is that, you know, they said time and time again about the show is what was most important to them was to not paint anyone as entirely good and anyone as entirely bad, leaving the mother out of it, who I find not even a person. The fact that when I watch this episode, I am team Titus Welliver and not team Mark Pellegrino. Like, Jacob sucks, mm-hmm. I think, in this episode. Less so when he's a kid, but, like, he sucks. And so I love that, like, you know, the guy wearing white, the guy who becomes God, is this, like, shitty snitch, and you know, his brother is like smart and interesting and like all this sort of stuff like that, and that's who becomes the devil. I think that's
yeah, well, and like it's it. And it's interesting that they base a lot of the direction their Jacob and the Man in Black's lives go around who believes the truth and who believes the lie, right? So you know, we have this great, pretty good scene between these two young actors where they're fighting about whether, you know, whether to believe the mother or not. And the guy who walks away with the truth, you know, is ultimately our villain on the show. But you almost have to think that Jacob would have had a better time if he would have accepted the truth, you know, and they would have, you know, spurned the mother together. But it was Jacob's, I don't know necessarily what you would call that, but his desire to believe the lie, at least at first, you know?
There's also that, like, mother likes you best sort mm-hmm. of thing. I kind of love that a lot, too, that, like, the Man in Black was the chosen kid, the favorite kid.
He was special.
Mm-hmm.
He could see dead people.
Yeah, I have some questions about that, but I don't know. I just, this episode's almost great. And it's not.
That's why I sort of like it. Like, it's not a fun episode to watch. And, like, you know, like, but I think about it a lot when I think about Lost. Like, if after this rewatch is over, when you think about episodes of Lost, this is going to be one of the ones you think about. Cause you're sort of like, what the, mm-hmm. what was that?
Yeah, well, because it's
what happened here.
It is a bold sort of left turn, which is the thing that we've expected Lost to do several times. But I don't, yeah, the context of like where they chose to tell this story and then, you know, the casting of Allison Janney as the, you know, eternal mother, who was on the island 2000 years ago. Yeah. It takes it from just being like a weird, bold story choice to being a very confusing and, deeply memorable hour of television.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and the bullet they dodged is to, you know, make another Game of Thrones reference. Like, as long as you don't do this with, like, a character, like, these are all new characters. As Neil pointed out, none of the characters people, like, learn to like. You could kind of get away with this a little bit easier.
Mm-hmm.
Because you'd just be like, oh, and that happened, which is how you'll talk about Across the Sea in the future. Be like, oh, yeah, because, you know, they were brothers and the mom and the brother, they're the skeletons.
I mean, thinking about it for a decade, which I have been, like the question about the end of Lost, it all becomes really sticky and bad, and like not bad in terms of the show's bad, because I like the finale, and we'll talk about that obviously in a couple weeks. But like, oh my God, we're so close, guys! It's so weird, but like bad in how tense the showrunners were, and bad in how wind up the fandom was, and all of that stuff that we recall from the end of Game of Thrones. But like, there's this question of like how much to reveal and how much to not. Like the guys get really defensive about like, you know, the things that they decide not to say, like, you know, who the guy Saeed shot on the golf course was or whatever. They're like, we're not going to tell you, and too bad if you need that answer. And I'm like, is that something people are really hung up on? Like, it's not, but like maybe then getting too specific, like if you mm-hmm. wanted to let the mystery be of the island, like, do we need to see like a ritual of how you become the island protector? Like, does it need to be literalized with a glowing light and a cave? Like, I feel like it's almost too specific for then how unspecific they want it to be, because they want it to be about character. That's what they keep saying, about characters, not about the mysteries. But mm-hmm. if you have characters grappling with a mystery, then you have to like engage with the mystery, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I think that that's one of the things that makes Lost such a fascinating thing to look back on, because it was Lost sort of came of age with social media, right? So like the people who are watching this final season of Lost were doing so in 2010, which is several years after Twitter and Facebook had become sort of big and existent. And Lost really was that show that sort of went through the breach first of like, what is it like to have this, you know, deep conversation over several seasons at an extremely high level with a fandom that is you know, right at your fingertips, you know, right there on social media. And you know, it's both a cautionary tale in a lot of ways. This, and I think this is an example of how it is cautionary. The over answering or the trying to anticipate what the audience, what answers the audience is really going to want versus what answers you feel are, you know, creatively most interesting. And we get the good and the bad in here in season 6 for sure.
Something that a bunch of the critics at the time were talking about was this idea of like, maybe there are satisfying answers to mystery box shows, but for the most part, the biggest juice is that moment before the discovery. Emily Vandergriff in her recap has this great story about like how when she was a kid, like she and some other neighborhood kids found a cave, and you know, like real Spielberg shit, right? Mm-hmm. Real Amblin Entertainment shit. Found a cave, got a flashlight, got so excited about what they might find in the cave, and like that moment where you're in the mouth of the cave and the possibilities are endless for what, and your mind is racing, what could be inside this cave? Is it like something fantastical? Is it like whatever? And then the reality is like, and there was a light at the end of the tunnel there, and they were like, what could it be? And then it was just like some farmer's field, right? And so it's like, so getting to the fields is maybe always going to be kind of, but there's better ways to tell us it's a field than some of the stuff that happens here, I think, mm-hmm, right?
For sure.
It also has some weird themes that we usually don't get in our Lost. First of all, hey guys, it was twins. I guess we had author Gary Troop, who was sucked into the plane engine in the pilot, was writing a book called Bad Twins, so maybe we knew it back further. But this, we don't
see, now that's a good
twin imagery.
That's a good one, and that, because that exists in the show, it's a nice little Easter egg. But they didn't have like a scene at the end of this where like someone's walking along the beach and they pick up the Bad Twins.
You pick up the book,
you know, just to remind you, you know.
Didn't flat like when Man in Black is born. It didn't flash to the copy of
Shannon
the Bad
reading
Twin.
Bad Twins on the beach.
Yeah, Luke and Leia time, right? Isn't it?
Yeah, sort of.
Well, I mean, I must have missed the one where Leia becomes a smoke monster. I thought she just, you know, was minorly force sensitive. Doesn't there have to be one dark?
Does there?
I mean, your other examples have like one that
okay, is Cain and Abel, Jacob and Esau, Romulus and Remus aren't. That's not one dark.
Like one isn't technically darker there. Yeah, yeah. But there's a lot of twins.
Well, I mean, Cain and Abel aren't twins, right?
No, they're just siblings. You're right.
Yeah, Romulus and Remus are twins. Jacob and Esau
are not twins, I don't think.
I mean, it's basically, you know, the oldest story in human history, or at least one of them, is that if there are two siblings, one of them is bad and one of them is good.
Jacob and Esau are twins, and I think that's the whole, like, birthright thing, is, like, one of them came out of the womb that much faster than the other. And so it's, like, the idea of birthright is... That's the annoying thing, is like, why don't you just name... I mean, I don't care the Man in Black has no name. And spoiler alert, will never have a name. But like, if you're going to call one Jacob, why wouldn't you just call the other one Esau? Like, why not? You know? Like, just do it.
Because the mother only thought of one name, Joanna.
Sure.
Oh, poor Claudia.
Didn't you watch the episode? and the other mother, you know, is... so detached from her own humanity at this point.
She's so deeply
for thousands of years.
She's deeply committed to not revealing any information until it's absolutely the last second to do so. Like, that's her whole vibe, the other mother.
She's only willing to address Jacob. So she has to ask, like, where's your brother?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and she sneaks up on the Man in Black. So she's never like, hey, boy. Just never needed a chance for a name.
Hey, you with the Bieber haircut. Do you know, can I tell you something that I only just realized this time watching the episode? And I've seen this episode many times. I always thought that the mother did leave that game on the beach for her kid to find.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no.
But no, she's definitely lying to like throw him off the scent of the fact that there are other humans on the island. But I just always thought she left it there for him, and I liked it because it like made her kind of complicated, because it was like, leave him a game there to like make him sort of curious and interested in like games and stuff like that. But no, she's just lying. I can't believe I didn't put that together.
Well, I mean, it does like sort of have a game element that, you know, gets added in. So I wouldn't say that you're that, I mean, you are often that she didn't put it there, but is it there by mistake? Just because the island protector is different, can the island still act?
Yeah, like, did the mother, Allison Janney's character, bring people to the island like Jacob does later? You know, like, was she trying to reel people in to also... you know, get a replacement? Because it seems like whoever is in charge of the island, that job must be terrible, because they're just trying to get rid of that job constantly.
Well, I mean, I think they've both been doing it for a very long time.
Sure. Yeah, I guess thousands of years of the same job would make for a not fun time.
Or maybe they both like, you know, Jacob and the Man in Black. Maybe the mother also has some sort of initial trauma before she became the protector / smoke monster, because she does distrust humanity. And if she had been isolated this whole time, like, why? There must have been more attempts either at attempts while she's the protector for humans to get the light, or something happened to her before she was a basically all-powerful being to make her, like, initially distrust humanity. Right?
Sure.
Is that reading too much into it?
No, I think, I mean, it is interesting that the Man in Black comes to the same conclusion, right?
Yes.
That he was very curious about humanity, and then he lived with them, and he's like, oh no, these people do suck.
So, yeah. Well, I have to get off the island, though, so what are you going to do?
But, like, what is he expecting to find off the island? Different, better people? I don't know. He just wants to know. I mean, it's so...
Don't tell him what he can't do.
It's so sympathetic, yeah? Though, to be like, he's been gaslit and lied to, and he just wants to see what's across the sea, man.
Yeah.
Just wants to go. If he has to kill everyone to do it, oh well, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, the further up the ladder you go, the more assholes you find, apparently, on the island.
Guess so. But this idea of humanity as bad is really interesting, because, like, because I kind of wish that the Man in Black were like, yeah, I've lived with them. They're this, they're that, they're this, they're that, and said all the bad things. But then he could have been like, but they're also, and like talked about that, you know.
But they also helped me build my donkey wheel.
Yeah, like have him be.
That's pretty cool.
Have him have that, like, that's the thesis of the show. They're bad, but they're good at the same time. You know what I mean? Like, that would have been great. And then, you know, sure, he dies and gets turned into smoke, so.
I don't want to kill anybody by leaving the island, but I will because I need to leave the island.
And I'm smoke now, so.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now I'm smoke. It's harder to hold on to that humanity when you turned into smoke. Which, again, maybe is Allison Janney was told that she needed to act emotionless. But again, bad choice, even if that's what we were going for. Joanna, we were talking before the podcast that you might have some insight. Why is it a cave of light? Why do you think it's a cave of light?
I think a couple things are going on here. One, I mean, we already heard in the podcast check-in, but they were talking a lot about midichlorians in this final season as them not wanting to go to the midichlorian level of explaining a mystery. But I think we should think about how important Star Wars is to these creators and, like, this idea of, like, the Force. This is, like, basically it's a balance thing. It's a Pandora's box thing. It's a balance thing, right?
Yeah, like, you know, the light in the cave exists a little bit in every human.
Right. That whole thing.
Yeah.
The Last Crusade, I think, has to be a big thing here. I mean, we're going to get to Jacquino Corner, but I find the Jacquino score in this episode very Grail themey to me. And then also the golden light in the cave reflected on the face of the mother and the boys is very Pulp Fiction, Ultimate MacGuffin, Marcellus Wallace's briefcase that allegedly contains his soul, right, in Pulp Fiction, is a glowing light that you never see the source of. So, I don't know.
Yeah.
Those are some thoughts.
But they also don't point to it and say, like, look, there's a soul in there. Don't ever look at it, though. I mean, No, all of those are definitely, you know, points. And then, as we heard also on the podcast check-in, they knew that Jacob was looking for a replacement protector, so the things protect what? And we heard that Man in Black tells Sawyer nothing, you know, you don't have to protect anything. And now we know not only is it just a fight to keep the smoke monster on the island, which, you know, it could have been, but there is something worth protecting. It's just an amorphous good. It's basically like saying, like, everything good is in there. So, like, we gotta keep it.
Yeah.
We gotta keep it going.
Well, it's like, you know, it's the answer to the ultimate question. You know, what is it that, like, fuels, you know, the existence, all of existence, right? What is the thing that gives humans the consciousness that other, you know, animals don't have? And in Lost version, it's this fucking cave and the light on this island of mystery. Like, that's the answer to the universe and everything. It's like, this light in here is what keeps everything good, or keeps everything moving.
In the words of that shitty poet David Morrissey, there is a light that never goes out. But it's in a cave on an island.
Yeah.
Something I do like, actually one of my favorite answers to a mystery in this episode, is when the man in black is talking to the mother and he says, like, I've looked all over for that cave that you showed us and I couldn't find it. And it's a confirmation to, I think, to a suspicion I had, which is that things move on the island, only reveal themselves to you when they want to. So, like, that's why we never saw the lighthouse before. That's why we never saw the cliff with the scale. You know, like, I've been all over this island. Explains
Jacob's cabin being in 900 different places. Yeah, I've been all over this island,
and I can't find that giant glowing light cave.
That's why at the top of this podcast, we didn't have a segment where we added to a map, because we knew it would be impossible to eventually end up with a map.
Well, and I think that that's an example of a fun way for Lost, the Lost writers, to, you know, find an answer to a question that I'm sure plenty of people have had. You know, we've had it many times throughout the season. Like, where was this thing? You know, the lighthouse is probably the best example. It's like, how did they miss the lighthouse walking around this island for several months? So I think that is an example of, like, fun exposition and fun answering of questions. Yeah. And, you know, so just it proves that they had the ability to do it. They just didn't quite nail all of it.
We had an importance put by the Man in Black, not only on the light, but electromagnetism, as Neil pointed out, and the water specifically, both through the ritual and the Man in Black says, you know, the water is part of it. They're going to manipulate the light and the water. Joanna, does that make you feel any better about any, like, the smoke monster summoning water toilet or the Saeed drowning pool?
No.
Let the bodies hit the floor. I saw the original lineup of Drowning Pool once. It was pretty sweet.
No. But it kind of reminds me of Lynch, of David Lynch's, like, thing with electricity, where I'm just sort of like, I don't understand it. I'll never understand it. But it makes sense to him. So then it kind of makes sense to me. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, do you understand David Lynch's thing with electricity? You know more about Lynch than I do.
No, I don't know his specific thing about electricity. I can't even remember what the 4-hour review of season 3 I watched on YouTube said it was. But some people, you know, have answers. I'm just, there's a line that this episode runs between, like, big mythic ideas and then, like, very specific ideas. And I'm guessing the water, we're supposed to think about it, but I don't think it hits with the degree of answers as something like it's hard to find the cave hits.
Mm-hmm.
Because I still, it doesn't make it make more, the water being connected to the light, wouldn't that mean Saeed would come back? Isn't that good light? Or is it, that's when the pool was dirty? I'm very confused.
Well, yeah, the water didn't go bad until after Jacob died, right? That's the whole thing with the water. It's like, when Jacob dies, the water is now poison. So what probably did work, taking a dead person to the temple and resurrecting them in that pool, used to work fine. Like, that's how Ben was saved. But, you know, once Jacob dies...
Yeah, but you come back
and
say
different water property.
Right?
Come back different if you take a dip in the pool.
I guess it's supposed to be telling us that when there is no protector officially for the island, you know, the evil comes out, I guess.
There's also this like show don't tell question about Lost in general. Like, something that I was reading about was this idea that, like, maybe the creators think that when they show us certain things, like, here's a quote. I think this is from Emily's recap in the LA Times, but she says, this is why I fear the producers think they've solved the questions of just what the sickness does to people by showing us how it affects Saeed, when really what we want is for someone to sit down and just explain the process to us, hopefully succinctly, granted, but we want that explanation. And I'm like, yeah, I've just spent the better part of the last, like, couple of years trying to figure out what the fuck the sickness is on Lost. And the answer is there is no clear answer, because no one ever, like, because it affects different people different ways, you know, and there's no consistency. And so it's like the idea that, like, but I'm trying to think of, like, well, the example that Emily gave that was a really good one is that sometimes on Buffy, Giles would just sort of, like, here's what this demon does. But it would happen so snappily and so wittily that you didn't like be like, oh, here comes some Giles exposition. You know what I mean? It's like, it's fun and it's fast and here we go. Mm-hmm. And the stuff with the sickness is just one example of many of some problems we can get here. Ultimately, like I said, I like the end of Lost, but this question of like, how much does this episode answer questions and how much does it raise new questions? Answer questions, raise new questions. Yeah. Is one we're still thinking about this many years later.
Yeah, because there are, you know, some episodes left. So there are, you know, more questions being answered. But in terms of like pure island lore, this is like our apex. And pure island lore is what I was jonesing for like back in season 2. And sort of got, I'm going to be honest, with season 5, like Dharma Initiative season even sings more in retrospect because it could have been this. But to the point you're talking about with like the sickness, I would have even been happy with a line that it affects everybody differently. Like, if you don't know it, lampshade you don't know it, don't lampshade it, don't just yada 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 over it, I think. Try to like own that. Or just don't answer the question. Like, there's, especially with some of the stuff that will end up being unanswered, many of which you might have been, you know, just introduced to in this episode, are also going to go unanswered. It's interesting.
Yeah, I think with the sickness, there's just too much variety in the way they try to answer that question. Like, what is the sickness? Where did it come from? And, yeah, because, like, what's his name? Daniel Rousseau's guy. He gets the sickness and then immediately, or, you know, we don't know if it's immediate, tries to kill Rousseau. But, you know, later, Saeed gets sick and it's more of a slow burn of Saeed just, you know, going dead inside. And then he comes back as a hero in the last second.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to derail us. Talking about sickness.
But it is.
We could get to Robert and the rest in another day.
But yeah, I think it's just it is explained in so many different weird ways throughout the course of the show that it never quite makes sense.
Yeah, we're not down with the sickness disturbed. Mm-mm. That's two. All right.
Three makes a row.
Yeah, I know. We're going to... 3 points makes a line. Let's go early 2000s metal bands. One of the other things that we return to here on Lost that sort of really poked its head up on the island for the first time in this season with the aforementioned conversation between Kate and John that we mentioned, or Joanna mentioned earlier in this podcast, is we're back to mommy issues. Who's behind the bad god? The bad god's bad adoptive mom.
Oh, fuck.
It seems like... I don't know. It seems like a weird pivot, but I guess I could see why they ended up using it, because if you're going to very quickly add the sort of island has this weird trauma for pregnant women, which comes across and connects us to our modern day stories, then you really quickly want to get to Jacob. So it would make more sense to have a mother lie than a dad being like, you were born of cabbages and I peeled back the leaves and you were there and you were children of the island. But I'm still not...
Born of Cabbages, that's your third metal band, right?
Born of Cabbages, yeah, of course. Everybody remembers Born of Cabbages.
That is kind of fun, because, like, let's say they had believed the lie. And you know, the ghost of Claudia and her shipmates had never come knocking on their door. That is a fun, like, godlike origin story, right? Like... You are my children, and I bore you, and it's just the three of us here on this island.
There's nobody else.
Zeus came by as a bull, and then he left. Now you are my godchildren. I don't know.
No, actually, I do. I guess I like it more on the mythical front. So I guess if I'm going to slide it back in, it's another one of the things of these episodes where I see what they're going for, but the episode doesn't play at that high level for me, that high metaphor level. For better or for worse, I don't want to keep slacking, like, kidding the show, beating this dead horse show, because as I pointed out...
Horse?
Unforgettable episode.
Yeah, an iconic episode of television.
Iconic episode of television.
Famous and infamous.
Yep.
And it just cannot be said enough. Titus Welliver.
Cannot be said enough. Titus Welliver. All right. Anything else before we hit corners?
Thanks. I mean, we should just say really quickly that the game they're playing is Senet, which is an old Egyptian, maybe considered one of the first games ever. So to go into your like whole "who are they, where are they from" question, which we've been trying to answer, I guess in the storm we were trying to answer, like, who are the Egyptians that built this Egyptian stuff that's on the island? I'm still not confident I have an answer. Why is Claudia speaking Latin? She's from Rome. Is the mother from Egyptian stuff? And if so, why does she look like Allison Janney?
That's where it falls apart. Once again, the fact that they cast Allison Janney.
She's a smoke monster. She could look like anybody whose dead body is on the island.
Sure. Or maybe the person who was in charge of the island prior to her was Egyptian.
I have a maybe answer to this, but it has to wait for the storm.
Fun.
Unfortunately, it's one of those things included in the final hours of Lost that we're rolling up on. So, Neil, let's wrap up Across the Sea with our corners. We got a Giacchino corner this week.
We sure do. Giacchino has introduced in this episode. Joanna shouted it out earlier as being a little more Indiana Jones. Like, it definitely has a more soaring quality to it, a more John Williams-y energy, I guess. It's the light theme, and it appears in a track called Don't Look at the Light, which plays over the scene where the mother is showing the two young boys the Cave of Light. And this is, you're going to want to keep your ears open for this across the last three episodes, because this is now a late-breaking important theme for Lost.
Dave, you were talking earlier about singing on the podcast. Can you sing the Grail theme from Last Crusade?
No, I don't think I could sing the Grail theme, but I can sing the Raiders theme, which is da, da,
da, da, da. I'm pretty sure the Grail theme is something like da, 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 da,
yeah, that sounds right.
Oh,
and
that
that's
sound
like
right.
Very close to what you hear when the mother's sitting in front of the cave. So.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
steal from the best, Giacchino. Steal from the best.
I mean, Don't Look at the Light is Raiders, so maybe it's just my mind went there. And I actually, when Neil said Don't Look at the Light, every time I think about that scene, I picture that who played Mary in Ravenwood?
Karen Allen.
Karen Allen.
Karen Allen and Harrison Ford are tied up and they have their eyes closed, and Steven Spielberg is off camera. He's like, oh, they're ghosts. Oh, it's terrifying. One's right by your head. Oh, and then people are like blowing air at them. And just the idea that then became like this scene, but Steven Spielberg had to describe to them these like special effects nobody had seen yet. It's great.
But I mean, I didn't go much into it, but like, you know, The Last Crusade, if you've never seen Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, spoilers for that film, that's about someone who has been guarding something very important
yes.
for a very long time and is ready to not be doing it anymore. And in order to become the new guardian, you have to drink from a vessel and then you are the new guardian. So, you know, very, very crusade, Last Crusade-y.
It is definitely up there. Hopefully everybody chooses wisely. Our accent corner. Joanna, we have an accent corner. It's been a hot minute.
Yeah, I already blew it. Allison Janney's from Ohio.
Allison Janney is this from one, Ohio.
This one might be just more of a ceremonial accent corner where we yeah. shout out the fact that Allison Janney is not a native Latin speaker.
But not even a convincing Latin speaker. No, like, Like Elizabeth Mitchell did better Latin than Allison Janney. Yeah, and I didn't look up where Claudia, the actress who plays Claudia, is from, but...
Oh, yeah, I guess.
But I just would not have put someone so aggressively American in this role.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about questions that this episode raises. The biggest one is why? Why Allison Janney?
This is the mother.
I mean, she's very good.
She's a great actress.
Other thing.
Yeah. Our Jungle of Mystery moment goes to the birth of the smoke monster, because in goes body, out comes smoke monster, out comes body, WTF.
Woman who plays Claudia, I don't know why I pronounced her name Claudia, is from Sacramento, California.
All right. So.
Hey.
But she's part Mexican.
Does slightly better at Latin.
Mm-hmm.
Our dumb, elaborate artifact of the week, show me glowing cave of warm light. Ding, ding, ding. Our Bruton for Carlisle Memorial Falling Down Award goes to the man in black who falls down that cave of light. Ding, yeah. Ding, ding. He falls down. All of these are going to be interconnected.
He actually falls down several times in this episode. He gets punched by his brother. He gets thrown against a wall by his foster mother, I guess we could call her. Yeah. And then he falls into the light cave and emerges as smoke.
He had several nominations for one winner. The John Locke Memorial Coming Back Award is, hey, that dagger. That's where that dagger is from. I bet you were wondering where the dagger was from. Well, it's from this episode.
Sure.
Guess I'm out of the book club. We have the Bible.
I just thought that would be the easiest. Cain and Abel, Jacob and Esau. Here we go.
Works. The Abs Eterno Award goes to Titus Welliver. Someone wrote, Sun's out, guns out, can't disagree.
That's
yeah.
Neil. People-
this is a shout out to his 2,000 years ago fashion on the island.
Oh, I love his sleeveless tee from 2,000 years
ago. For a moment, I had a thought to give this one to Jack from the end of the episode, but I don't know if it's fair to give an Abs Eterno Award to someone who didn't have to shoot any new footage for the episode. So.
Yeah, that's right. We don't know. Those abs are old.
Yeah, we've seen those abs before.
Put your abs away, Matthew Fox. You've had your turn. I do think that first shot you get of Titus Welliver, like, you know, when he's aged up. He's
holding
Titus
the rope Welliver, real tight.
And he's like, looks over his shoulder and you're like, hello. How are you doing? You look great. Anyway,
Through the looking glass, we don't have any sideways, but Mother is reflected in the water. That's how we first see her in the opening scene. Ben's talking, so it's Odyssey Ally Award doesn't apply specifically, but the mother, the other mother, does tell the children, I am your mother, but we definitely see her kill the real mother.
She also says a lot of other stuff, like, there is no across the sea. There is only island. There is only us. I think we should change the corner to Mother's Talking, so it's obviously a lion. Because Ben's been out of the lion game for a while now.
We're never going to see Mother again, so... I feel like we got to leave it to
it would have to be the
at least the best at it.
The other mother memorial.
The
mother
other
is
mother
talking
memorial.
Awards. Mother is talking, so it's obviously a lie award. It'll be the longest award we give out ever.
Our Jungle of Kistery. Who was running this last week? It seems like Joanna might have been running it.
It's true. Joanna did this. We had an unusual poll this last week because listen. I didn't want to put anyone up against Sun and Jin. It's just Sun and Jin. And then the other option was that's it, that's the poll. So that's it, that's the poll. Got 13% of the vote. And Sun and Jin got 80%. Can't even get 100% of the vote when it's their own poll. But
I respect those 13.1% because they're like, I could just not participate, but you know what? Fuck this.
Don't
they
tell me what
know.
I can't do.
Yeah, exactly.
I can only imagine what's going to be the Kistery poll for Across the Sea. It's just going to be very existential and strange.
Mm, yes. It's going to be, Well, if you want to go right now to twitter.com/storepodcast, it'll be there. And make sure to put in your vote. All right. The Charlie Pace Memorial Final Words Award goes to Mother, who says, thank you. Finally gets released from this mortal coil. Released from this smoke monster coil. The Frank Lapidus Guess We're Not Going to Guam Act Break Award goes the mother who says it will have to be one of you to protect the light. It's Jacob.
I mean,
and she's like, it was always going to be you. I'm dumb, apparently.
We've said a lot of things about Allison Janney's character, the mother, but in the end, she's winning a very high percentage of all of our corners. And that's got to be a record compared to other characters.
It's the most horrible person you know makes a great point, Onion headline of corner awards. All right, we gave out a lot of awards. Joanna, you want to turn this donkey wheel and go back in time to an interview?
I wonder if in that conversation with Alan, I was like, wow, I love Allison Janney in this episode. Well, let's find out. Let's hear what past Joanna and Alan Sepinwall had to say. Alan Sepinwall, welcome back to the podcast. Hello.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here and to be talking about this episode in particular.
You had your pick of the litter, and this is the puppy you picked for the last final season.
I'm either a masochist or I just like, I mean, there was a part of me like, okay, I'll just take Recon. That's easy. I've always liked that one. It's just, you know, Sawyer Miles, buddy cop. Let's do that. But then I thought, come on. Like, I wanted to see this one again. I have not watched it since it originally aired decade ago.
Wow.
And I was curious, like, if you take it away from the context of the great disappointment that Across the Sea was when it originally aired, would it play better? Like, is it actually good as an episode removed from all the expectations that we had for it? So I wanted to see.
And broad strokes, what's your feeling on that?
It still has a lot of problems, but there's parts of it I liked now that I was incapable of liking back then, because the whole time back then I was just saying, why are we doing this? Why?
Okay. Before we get into that, I just want to mention, Alan, that like you have, I think since the last time we talked, launched this really cool podcast project, or maybe you just anyway, let's talk about it again. What is this podcast project that you are doing with some of our favorite TV and film folks?
It's called Too Long Didn't Watch, and it's a high-concept TV podcast where me and a celebrity guest in every episode, we find a show they have never seen before, and I only show them the pilot and the series finale and nothing else, and they have to see if they can understand what happened in between.
I mean, what's your favorite one so far? You could just tell us. No one will know which you picked.
I mean, we did a really good one in the first season where Paul Scheer watched Dexter, and like by the end, he was just booing, like openly booing the Dexter finale, which is, you know, if not the dream we had when we first came up with the podcast, it was certainly one of the good scenarios. That was great. The disappointment so far is we have not, for understandable reasons, been able to get anyone to do Lost, because Lost is kind of the proof of concept show for the podcast. But the pilot and the finale are just so incredibly long that, you know, it's hard to find anyone who's willing to put in that amount of time.
All right. Well, you know, we'll keep our fingers crossed. You're going to tell me right as soon as you book the Lost interview who it is, because, you know, I'm going to be really excited.
Of course okay. I will.
All right. So do you know when that's coming back?
It's hopefully coming back sometime this summer. We're still sort of figuring out a few logistics, but it should be relatively soon.
Okay, fun summer listen for everyone. Let us talk about Across the Sea. Let's contextualize a little bit for the folks at home. Can you sort of explain like where Allison Janney was sort of in the public consciousness, and like, you know, what level of cameo or guest appearance was this at the time?
This was still a big deal because she was multiple Emmy winner, Allison Janney. She definitely had at least two, I think, at that point for West Wing. So she was known for having been on the West Wing, but she wasn't, you know, all caps Allison Janney, where she was now sort of like had a million Emmys and now has the Oscar, and sort of anywhere she pops up, it's sort of like, oh, she's a national treasure. But it was still like, here's someone from this other very successful and acclaimed show whose run overlapped a little bit with Lost, and she's coming in to do this, to play a character we've never seen before in an episode with higher stakes than maybe anything the show had ever done.
And how much was known about this episode before it aired? Do you remember?
I'm trying to. I do remember a couple things. One is I had been sort of talking with Damon Lindelof in that final season about the idea of me interviewing him and Carlton at some point. And Damon said relatively early on, we're doing this episode. I forget what the number was. But he says, when we get to 5X, you should talk to us. That'll be a really fun one to talk about. And I think back then he had a sense that like people were going to be really excited by Across the Sea. And so that's why he wanted to do the interview. I'm trying to remember how much you would know better than I do. How much press were they doing hinting about what this was going to reveal?
I think they just had all season been sort of promising a lot of mythological answer. I mean, it's the whole final season trap, right? Something that we've talked about a lot on the podcast is like the final season and what feels successful and what feels less successful, right? And like you and I talked about the finale, and I think even in Damon and Carlton might agree that like the emotional character stuff winds up feeling a lot more successful in the mythological. So I'm not even one of those people that's like lost answered, no questions. I don't really actually care that much. But I think in terms of what they landed, and I think a problem, something that they wouldn't do again, and certainly something that Damon like defiantly didn't do with the leftovers, you know, like let the mystery be, was like promise answers. Do you know?
Yeah.
And so the promise of answer is lingering in the air around this episode, you know.
And it's not just the promise of answer. There's two different things going on here. There's one, we have these huge expectations that like, how is the show going to finally explain what the island is, what's special about it, why has all of this been happening? But the other thing is the episode directly before this ends with the submarine blowing up and a bunch of our beloved characters apparently dying.
Right. Yep.
So there's this huge, intense cliffhanger about the characters we've been watching from like the first episode of the show, who we care so much about. Did they live? Did they die? What the hell is going to happen? And Across the Sea opens with like what looks at first, oh, it's the submarine wreckage. Maybe Jin is alive. Maybe Sun is alive. Maybe it's going to be okay. And they're very deliberately toying with us in that way. And instead, we get an entire hour that has nothing to do with that and is all island backstory. So I think like it's already sort of setting itself up unintentionally to fail just with that, because people were so on edge and emotional about what had happened in the previous
one. Yeah. That's a great point. I had forgotten about the previous episode context, because for context for listeners, we're recording this a bit early in our final season rewatch. And though I rewatched the final season a couple times, I had sort of forgotten how, and because I've been rewatching it, in a cluster, we're watching it week to week. But when I do my like sort of refresher rewatches, I'm watching in a binge. But like, having to wait 2 weeks to find out what happens after the submarine explodes. That's unkind.
It reminds me of a story that Mindy Kaling once told me, which will seem off topic until it isn't, which is Mindy Kaling wrote what is sort of universally considered the funniest episode of The Office, The Injury, where Michael, grills his foot on a George Foreman grill. And I was talking about it with her years later, and I said, everyone thinks this is the funniest episode. And she says, it's very nice to hear that, because when it aired, NBC aired it out of order. And it aired in between the episode where Michael finds out that Jim has a crush on Pam and when they actually deal with that. And so at the time it aired, like she said, all of the Office fans were really angry with her on whatever the version of the internet was back then, because they thought she's just trolling them. Like, they want to know what's happening with Jim and Pam. And instead, it's like Michael asking if the gas station in Carbondale had fresh yams. It's just not at all what they wanted in that moment. And I don't know that Across the Sea would have ever been what Lost fans wanted, but in that moment, it was really not what we wanted.
I'm wondering, why... Well, here's what I'll say. I think there are later versions of this episode that like Damon did, or at least he did like cold opens in Leftovers. I don't think Carlton has ever, like, Carlton's taste hasn't really swung this way in his post-Lost work.
No.
That have been more successful, more embraced than this. Like, sort of discursive backstories in Watchmen or something like that. Like, what do you think the difference is between those versions and this version?
I think it's sometimes it's an emotional thing. Like, you know, it's the Watchmen, the famous sort of black and white backstory episode of that is we're following a character we've already known. It's a younger version of that character. And we've got one of the main characters of the show's present day kind of layered on top of that in this weird Quantum Leap situation. And we're getting a lot of information for the people who knew the comic that ties right into the comic book. So there's a lot of different ways in which you're connected to it from the jump, whereas this is much more abstract. It's still about the island, and it still involves Jacob and the smoke monster, but like they're really not the versions of the characters that we've known previously. So that's a hard part. And I mean, the thing that it actually reminds me of the most from what Damon has done since then is the cavewoman opening from Leftovers season two. But like, that's 5 minutes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's sort of, you know, that's more of like a thematic, like, here's what the show's about, and here's what the show is about to become, that we can now go back to cavewoman times. It's a statement more than it is. Like, I don't think I would have wanted to watch a whole Leftovers episode about the cavewoman, but as a teaser, it's incredible.
Yeah, there's also that, like, what's the other Leftovers cold open where like everyone's getting on their roofs? It's like the religious sort of. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I wish I was ready, or something. Whatever that great song is. It's wonderful. Yeah.
Anyway. All right. So I will say this. I find this episode a mixed bag, and I find a lot of the like attempts to explain things and in literalize things here at the end of Lost a little frustrating, a little more unnecessary than frustrating. Do you know what I mean? And I think some of the stuff that happens in the final season with like the temple or the lighthouse or the cave, like all these like places and artifacts and stuff like that, I just feel like I feel like there's a more abstract version that would ultimately be more satisfying than trying to literalize and explain things that it's a glowing light in a cave and all that sort of stuff. How does that mythological reveal work for you?
It's not great. I mean, like I said before, there are parts of the episode I wound up liking now that I didn't then. The Golden Pool of Light is not one of them. I think you're right. Like, you know, when Michael turns up to explain that the whispers are ghosts of people who died, none of that really is satisfying throughout this season. And I think part of it is because it's too much like, you know, like an FAQ where they're like, well, what are the whispers? Oh, they're ghosts. Well, why does the island behave this way? Oh, there's a golden pool of light. Well, how, you know, what does the wheel do?
What are the numbers? Like, yeah.
Exactly. None of that is good. And I think part of it is because the show generally worked better as a feeling than it did as fact.
Yeah.
So when the polar bear rushes out of the brush in the pilot, that's amazing. When they start actually explaining why the polar bear is there, I kind of wish I didn't know.
And that's
a very hard thing to do, but it's, I think they would, it less would have ultimately been better than more, even though people would have been yelling about, you know, I want answers, I want explanations. The explanations just weren't great.
Do you liken that to, like with Twin Peaks, when the network sort of made Twin Peaks in season two give us an answer of who killed Laura Palmer, and that just sort of tanked what the show was about? Do you know what I mean? That Twin Peaks works as a vibe rather than like an actual mystery to be solved.
Well, I'd say the difference there is that the actual resolution of the Laura Palmer murder is incredible. Like those 9 episodes of season 2 leading up to, you know, the conclusion, those are all great. Like that's some of the best TV that's ever been made. It's more like they insisted on continuing the show afterwards. I don't know that Twin Peaks necessarily could have kept stringing out the Laura Palmer thing a lot longer, even if Lynch and Frost had wanted to. But like once they did that, there was no show. And that then became a big problem. And suddenly all the quirky stuff took it over, and that was bad. But I don't know what they could have done, because they'd spent so many years teasing these things, both on the show and in the podcast and Comic-Con appearances and interviews and everything. And it was it becomes like, you know, to borrow an item from a franchise that Damon's been associated with, like it's the no-win scenario of the Kobayashi Maru. Like, I don't know what they could have done. I just know that this mostly doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about what does work. You know, I think this is an incredible performance from Titus Welliver, who is like one of our finest TV actors. and good stuff from Mark Pellegrino too. And I think when you say like these are characters we've seen but not as we've known them, I love getting that shading on those characters. Like this is a classic Lost tool, right? Like let's show yes. you the previously on of this character that you think you know. You think you know who's the good guy and who's the bad guy and who's the good god and who's yeah. the devil and all that sort of stuff like that. And like the petulance and mama's boy sort of stuff that's shaded into Jacob and the like you know, root forable aspect of the smoke monster, the man in black. I love. What do you think?
No, Welliver is incredible in this. Like, this may be, and I've enjoyed a whole lot of stuff he's done over his entire career. This may be the best thing I've ever seen him do just for, like, one episode of television. Yeah. There, like, sort of just the rage when he finds that, like, Mother has burned the village and killed his people and all of that is really extraordinary. And the scene where he then goes back and kills her. That's great, and the family dynamic is really fascinating to me, and also kind of the episode as a metaphor for Lost itself, whether it's intentional or not, is great, because it's like all of these problems come about because Mother won't share information with the kids.
Right.
She just won't answer their questions. She's always cryptic. She's always sort of stringing things out, and a whole lot of people wind up dying as a result. And even, like, the man in black is turned into Smokey as a result of her never having quite told Jacob, like, don't put a guy into the pool of light because this will happen. Right. You know, and I think to a degree, like, Lost stumbled because they didn't want to answer things sooner, it creates this big problem for them that is maybe as bad as, you know, for them as the emergence of the smoke monster is for Jacob.
What do you think of Allison Janney's performance or characterization of this figure?
I mean, she's very good. She's always super watchable. It's the character's kind of a problem because she exists largely as this cryptic obstacle who's not explaining what she's about or what her motivations are. And I know it's sort of meant to be a parallel to what's been going on with Ben and the others and this whole idea of who's the good guys and who's the bad guys that you were talking about. And she claims that she's good and the villagers are bad, when in fact it seems to maybe be the opposite. But I think a lot of that is just resting on the Janney performance as opposed to the writing. Yeah. I don't feel like she's given enough to play there or enough context for why she's acting this way.
How intentional, I mean, this is going to require you to like sort of armchair analyze Carlton Damon, but you have a long association with them, so maybe you feel comfortable doing that. Like, how intentional is the meta aspect of like, a figure withholding mysteries from the people who want the answers? Like, how much are they casting themselves as the mother figure here?
I feel like that, whether it's intentional or not, I feel like that's absolutely what they are doing. I mean, I remember once when I interviewed Carlton for The Revolution Was Televised, and we were talking about the polar bear cage sequence. Mm-hmm. He said something along the lines of like, look, Damon and I were really unhappy and trying to get out of the show at that point. I don't think it's an accident that we put our three main characters into cages for six episodes.
Right.
So like, whether they were thinking about it or not, that's clearly like somewhere in their subconscious and filters into how they write Mother.
Oh, you want to talk about Giacchino in this episode. What do you want to say about Michael Giacchino?
Well, I just like Giacchino is always amazing, but there's a specific bit when Mother takes Jacob down to the pool and she's going to do the ritual where she's going to have him drink from the water and he becomes the island's new guardian. I just remember like I was taking notes while I watched this so that you and I could talk about it. And I just wrote down in all caps, this is some good Giacchino-ing. Like, it's just really the way the fact that even after all of these years, he could still come up with new variations that could feel like so beautiful and moving. Yeah. You know, it's a hot take, and I apologize for going out on a limb like this, but Michael Giacchino is really good at what he does.
Oh, wow. I mean, so brave of you.
Somebody had to say it, and I'm going to be the one.
So brave and so true. What would you have placed, if this had been placed before the submarine or after the conclusion, you know, like where, if this had been placed elsewhere in the season, do you feel like it would have been a much more well-regarded episode?
I mean, I think there's always going to be the problem of, you know, people saying, wait a minute, all of this happened because of a glowing pool of light. Like there's no way around that. That's a problem. But I do think there are sort of less propulsive portions of the season. Like it's been a while since I've watched the whole thing, but I feel like there's some stretch in between the temple stuff and when people start dying again, where things are relatively chill, where they could have done this.
Yeah.
And at least you would have avoided that problem. There would have been the larger problem of the explanation itself being less than satisfying. But I think it wouldn't maybe not have inspired quite the howls that it did at the time.
How does like the temple stuff and some of that other stuff that happens this season, I mean, in your memory, which I know might not be the freshest about it, but like how does all like when I guess – you know, obviously we haven't talked about the finale and the episodes come after this episode on the podcast yet. So we can't talk about that. I know what your memories of those are because we talked about that before.
Yes.
But like when you think about the final season of Lost, like leading up to this, like what are your memories? What did you like? What was working for you?
Okay, so here the stuff that I liked were, number one, I liked Jack again. That to me is the big miracle of season six, is they, like, he was the character I hated most in all of television for a number of years, because he just seemed to me like a symbol of all the more annoying aspects of Lost. Like he was just sort of this stubborn, obstinate guy who didn't care about getting the answers, and maybe in hindsight he was right about that, but like Jack kind of existed to be like a buzzkill, where anytime something cool was about to happen or something was about to be explained on the show, Jack would step in and throw a tantrum and it would stop. And what they were able to do both in the present day stuff and especially in the Flash Sideways stuff was really like remind me, oh yeah, when this pilot began, I thought Matthew Fox was awesome. I really like this character. And so that's all good. I really liked most of the Sideways stuff. The resolution of the Sideways, we could talk about it in another context, but the actual Sideways storylines were really a lot of fun, whether it was something light like Sawyer as a buddy cop with Miles in I guess LA, or whether it was something a bit deeper like what's going on with Desmond. Like those were all really a lot of fun. And there's some good moments. Like I remember Ben on the beach crying and talking about like how the smoke monster is the only one who will have him at this point. You know, it's these actors are always going to be great. You know, you give Michael Emerson or Terry O'Quinn or Elizabeth Mitchell something to do, and they're going to do it really, really well. I'm not as down on the final season overall as I think a lot of people are. I think this episode kind of exists as a big stick with which to beat the entire season. And there's definitely missteps, and the temple's pretty boring. But overall, I think I liked more of the last year than I didn't. And I just think it was sort of like they had set this impossible task in front of them. I'm just not sure there was any way to safely land the plane. And they tried to do something big, and parts of it worked and parts of it didn't. And I would rather that they tried than that they attempted something a lot more conservative.
I like that. Yeah. Like it's a big swing, and sometimes it's a messy swing, but like better to swing than not. Right. And, I was thinking about this in the context of actually one of my favorite episodes of the final season, which is Ab Eterno, which is the Richard flashback.
I love
that episode. Yes. I think, you know, speaking to sort of some of your critiques of this episode, like Ab Eterno has some on-island modern day stuff going on. You know what I mean? It's a classic flashback episode of Lost in that Richard's on-island journey is connected to what's happening in this flashback, and we hop back and forth. It's a classic sort of season one scenario.
I like Richard, and I care about Richard in a way that, to be frank, I don't care about Jacob.
Yes.
Like Jacob to me is a plot device. You know, I think Pellegrino's good. I'm not knocking him. It's just there's only so much that you can do with sort of the god figure who's been manipulating events often behind the scenes. And this reminds me of something, by the way. I don't want to forget to ask this. Okay, I've only been watching the episodes that you and I have talked about for this podcast. Yeah. Like, that's all of Lost that I've revisited since I think I wrote Revolution Was Televised, which is years and years ago now. So I have no memory of what the actual explanation is. In The Man Behind the Curtain, when Ben takes Locke into the cabin and they get the brief glimpse of the man in the rocking chair.
Yeah.
Is that Jacob? Is that Smokey? Is that someone else entirely?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's one of those muddy, we don't have a definitive answer, but I think there's one point in the final season more something like, Jacob had moved from the cabin to the foot of the statue. What a thing to say. And and I think Alana says something like, he hasn't been here for a long time or something like that, which makes you believe that. And the ash line is broken. It makes you believe that, like, most of the things we saw in that cabin were probably smoky, you know?
The only reason I even really care about it is more this idea of, like, you know, Ben has been spending all these years claiming that he is acting as, you know, Jacob's surrogate, and yet we sort of find out that he's never really heard from Jacob. So I'm just sort of trying to figure out, like, has Smokey been manipulating him? I can't remember all the different pieces.
Well, the answer to that is that Ben was lying the whole time.
Okay, Ben's just lying.
And saying that he had a direct line to Jacob when he had never spoken to him. So.
Okay, gotcha. All right.
Classic answer for any question. Ben lies. I want to talk to you about the core driving engine of Lost, which is the conflict between parent and child. And, like, obviously, this is like we did a twist. It's a mommy issues episode. It's not a dad. It's not a bad dad. It's a bad mom sort of situation. Yes. But, like, isn't Jacob, like, the ultimate bad dad, like, bad sky dad? Like, isn't this a series about how God is the biggest bad dad of them all? What do you think, Alan?
No, I think that's entirely right. Like, Jake, he is very much a mama's boy in these scenes, and he's very much his mother's son through the rest of the series. Think about how many different tragedies could have been avoided over, like, the various timelines that are depicted across Lost if only Jacob had been, like, much more upfront and involved in what was happening on the island instead of sort of hanging back and trying to, you know, manipulate by proxy and not tell people what was actually going on. So much of, you know, there's a famous, if you're my age or probably really even older, Woody Woodpecker cartoon where, like, a narrator keeps saying this line over and over again. If Woody had gone straight to the police, none of this would have happened, until finally Woody, like, yells at the narrator to shut up. And there's a lot of, like, if Jacob had just, like, been up front with people, none of this would have happened. Yeah. So, you know, it's... So, yes, it's a mom, and I guess it's a twist, but she acts in the same way that so many of the bad dads on this show do. Right. Lost is definitely has questionable issues with parents, even though, you know, I know that, like, Damon is, you know, idolizes his own mother, so...
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting universal sort of psychic wound struggle sort of thing. Like, even with good parents, there's still that sort of, like, messy, Oedipal, like, all of that sort of power conflict, we are what they grow beyond kind of stuff that's in there, you know, so it's interesting. All right. Well, I mean, I think we kind of did it, unless there's anything else you want to say about Across the Sea.
I think we did. I will say I did not hate it this time. It's definitely, it's an interesting, it's a very watchable episode. It's well shot. Like I said, the Giacchino stuff is great, and Titus and Janny and Pellegrino are all really, really good in it. It's just sort of, it's just a bad idea.
Yeah.
It's just they shouldn't have done it, or they should have done something else. And I have to wonder, and they'll never talk about this, at what point they came up with the Golden Pool of Light as their sort of get out of jail free card to explain the remaining mysteries, because it just, no, guys, you are capable of doing better. You should have done
better. We've seen you do better before and after. This is not it. Yeah. I mean, I just think they were, I mean, I don't know, but, like, I have to think that they were just like, oh my God, I don't know. The numbers are on a cave wall and also in the lighthouse. And I don't, you know, not that it was thoughtless, but they were just like, you know, there's so much pressure. The reason we started this podcast was at the end of Game of Thrones. We were just sort of like, huh, let's look at another, like, big pressure cooker of a finale that, you know, landed sourly with a lot of people.
But the difference is, I feel like opinion has turned on the end of Lost. Not with everyone. There's still lots of people who are bitter about it and will hold it up as an example of, like, what not to do and why I don't care about these kinds of shows anymore and how they wasted 6 years of my life and blah, 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 you know. But I do feel like there's a lot more people who have come around to saying, well, okay, well, maybe it's not perfect, but I like, sort of like I said before, I like more of it than I didn't. and I like more of that finale than I didn't. And I, you know, I do miss Lost. And I just, it's just so hard to see with Game of Thrones, which is one of the shows we did on Too Long Didn't Watch.
Yeah.
We did with Alison Brie, and she was watching it, and even she was like, what is this? Like, I can tell already that I wish I had seen a couple of episodes before this. That would have been more exciting. So I can't imagine opinion on that show and that finale in particular turning as much. It's just, it's, I know it's fresher than that, but it seems really salted the earth in a way that I don't think even at the time the Lost finale did.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's right. It's just hard because we haven't had the same amount of time with Thrones. Like, I'm sitting here thinking I'm never going to feel about Thrones the way I feel about the Lost finale, right? Which is, I like the Lost finale. I didn't hate it violently at the time, the Lost finale, but I also, like, have grown to love it even more and kind of defiantly. And I do think that, like, people who rewatch Lost are like, oh, I don't remember why I was so angry about that. That's really beautiful and emotional and all that sort of stuff like that. But there's, you know, I get this all the time. You might get it anytime you tweet about Lost. I get people in my mentions every time being like, what a waste of my life. You know, it's like they're, they're like unwilling to re-examine. You know, it just has that reputation and it's just sort of hanging around it unfairly, I think. But that's sort of part of the work we're doing here is to trying to get people.
And I'm curious because you have been doing these mini binges. It feels to me that Lost is a show that, like, the binge is its friend. There's a lot of things that were annoying at the time when it was on the air that would not be now. Like, you get to the end of, you get to the end of Exodus and they're looking down the hatch and you don't have to wait 3 months to find out what's in the hatch. Right. You just start playing the very next episode there on Hulu. So,
I'm not to toot our own horn, but I do like sort of the middle ground that we're doing here is we're doing, like, you know, a week at a time. So we do have a week, you know, and there's, I think we took a couple weeks off at the end of the last season or something like that. But, like, no, there's never like a month or 8 months or whatever it is between seasons, you know, we're keeping it fresh. But I do like, I mean, as opposed to a true binge of Lost, where you're just mainlining episodes, I do like the week in between to discuss and think. And we've got some newcomers who are watching who are like theorizing as well. Like, how beautiful to have people who don't know how Lost end and are like in the year of our Lord 2021 writing Lost theories. Like, I think that's a really cool thing. So, I think you and I are both advocates of the week to week to watch, but without those
absolutely
long gaps.
Without those long, you know, I remember like with Sopranos, it could be off the air for close to 2 years. So
yeah,
no,
and
Thrones, don't like that.
Thrones too. I mean, that didn't help Thrones either, I think. So like, you know, I wish Thrones well. Maybe someday I will feel up for, you know, and maybe soon. We've considered like ending this whole thing by rewatching the final season of Thrones, but I don't know that I'm ready. It's getting close, and I don't know if I'm ready for that.
I will say that the finale did not play well when Alison Brie.
What other ringing unendorsement do you need than the Alison Brie disapproval?
I gotta say, but just try to imagine for a moment.
Yeah.
Lost is coming to an end. It's sort of this problematic final season where people are complaining about various things, you know, and in the midst of this, ABC announces, hey, we're developing 4 different Lost spinoffs at the same time. And we're going to like, you know, try to roll one out within a few years of when Lost ends, you know, and then the show ends with the level of disapproval that it got at the time. And now the spinoffs got to come along and sort of try to get people to love Lost again.
Yeah. Yeah, I have no idea what's going to happen. Fire and blood. Like, I have no idea. Like, do you have
sense? Want it to be good. I like when TV's good.
Yeah.
That excites me. Yeah. You know, that makes me happy.
There's some great creative people working on it. Do you know what I mean? Like, some of our favorite Thrones folks are running the show over there. So that's good news. But yeah, I don't know if I were like, I understand if you're Warner Brothers and you have this property, you paid for this property, you want to milk this property, but like, I'd give it a rest. I'd give it more time if I were them. Do you know what I mean?
I'm curious, like, can you sue your own showrunners for damages for like damaging the property going forward?
I don't know. Like, what do you think about like sorry, I know we're off topic here, but I'm curious.
We're going wildly off topic, but that's okay.
Well, like, what do you think about like the future of, like, what can Weiss and Benioff do next that people are going to be excited by?
Well, I think they're sort of very clever in that their next TV show, at least, that they're acting as producers, I don't know how actively, yeah, but is the Amanda Peet thing, the Chair on Netflix that she co-created. And so, like, it's a very different thing from Thrones, my understanding. It takes place, like, at a liberal arts college in New England. And so as a result of that, like, they'll at least have shown that they can do something else and whether or not people like it. And then it's a matter of whether anyone gives them credit for it. But it feels like between the end of Thrones and the whole Confederacy problem and then the Star Wars problem, just perception wise, they've dug themselves a very deep hole right now. And we will see how folks respond to the stuff they do after.
Yeah. The three body problem is another sort of, I mean, we'll see. I like, you know, I don't wish them ill. It's just so interesting. Like when a creator, I mean, Damon went through this, right? There was a time when like Damon Lindelof's name was kind of mud. I would say not even just after Lost, but like after Prometheus, I think is sort of
Prometheus. And also like he was one of the people working on Star Trek Into Darkness. And so, you know, it's definitely he became an easy punching bag for a lot of different things. Right. And then The Leftovers came along, and God, I wish more people had watched The Leftovers. And I assume you are regularly on this podcast telling the people who love Lost to watch The Leftovers,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes, yes. Obviously.
Watch The Leftovers, people. It's amazing. It's so good. It's so good.
Yeah. I mean, I'm one of those who like had a lot of issues with the first season of The Leftovers. It was a little dank for me to get through, but
you're not wrong about that. I love it, but I totally 100% will allow that it's tough sledding to get through, but then
yes,
it is so worth it, and you're all downhill from there, and the climb in hindsight will feel worth
yeah,
it.
Yeah, season 2 and season 3. My boss Mike Hogan is the one who was like made me and Dustin Rolls of Jaiba both made me stick with The Leftovers when I really wanted to quit, and they were both defenders of the first season, and then the second season came along, I'm like, oh boy, am I glad I got bullied into staying on this show. So yeah 2 and 3, so great. And then Watchmen, of course. Yeah, so it's like, yeah, you know, what a beautiful like redemption arc for Damon. Carlton has like gone on to like reliably put out things that people like to watch. You know, it's maybe there's a future for Weiss and Benioff. I think if I were them though, I would just like, you're right, they're sort of like they're hanging out in the background for a little bit. We'll see what happens. I don't know. What a world.
Yeah.
All right. Alan Sepinwall, I think this is probably our last time that we're going to talk for this podcast.
Oh man.
Well, look,
this, if I got to go out, what a way to go out. Like I could not have, I was like, as you said, I could have picked almost any episode from this season and I chose Across the Sea because that is just how I roll. And I'm so glad, Joanna, it is always so much fun to talk about these shows. Whenever the next podcast is, please have me back.
Oh, Alan, I would love that. Thank you. And and otherwise, you know, you and I will just see each other in G Chat asking questions about Marvel Comics to each other. It sounds like,
yes,
a plan.
We are nerds.
All right. Thanks, Alan. Folks can find you at Rolling Stone, in the magazine, online, and where can they find you on Twitter?
I'm Twitter at Sepinwall, and I'm on Instagram at Sepinwall, and on Facebook I'm at Alan Sepinwall.
Beautiful. Easy. Beautiful branding. Thanks, Alan. I'll talk to you soon.
Now is the time of the podcast where we'd like to thank our small council / candidate subscribers. These are the folks on our Patreon who give $10 or more every month. They're fantastic. We'll start with some new folks. Thank you to Sophie, Jeremy Brown, Patrick McKinnon, Alex Rongen, Sean McAuliffe, Brittany Cano, Kelly Grady, Patrick Sullivan, Grace Richardson, Joshua Lane, Bettany Townsend, Danielle, Justin Young, Harrison Fox, John Stahl, Aaron Miller, Heather Ogden, Daniel Bultema, Adam Wells, and Louise Collins. Thank you all so much.
And I want to add to that a list of candidates that get our boundless thanks. We have Michael Filippini, Michael Belitsky, Paul, and here's the thing, Paul. Your name could be Tyrell, your name could be Tyrell, because we used to be a Game of Thrones podcast and you've been with us since February 2019. it still says maybe Tyrell in the pronunciation thing because we love Game of Thrones. Let us know if we're wrong. Thank you, Dre, Sean Strigfield, Warpstone, Derek Bachman, Clark Ainsley, Dimitri Portnoy, Melissa Horsefall, Mariana Cotto, Nate, Robbie Rupas, Emily Ralph, Amy Gomez, Corey Schneider, Chris Miracle, Diane Mitchell, Amy Calhoun, and Mark Tozer. Thank you very much.
And I would like to thank the following fine humans: Christina Sullivan, Saquon Gatling, Reed Larson, Liz Zellickson, Gabby B., Deanna Miller, Rebecca Addison, Michael Hine, Aaron Michael Agostini, Joe Measures, Bryce Quine, Ira Storm, Melissa Slaughter, Great on Toast, Victoria McDuffie, Marianne Donnelly, Jim Scott, Fiona Grimm, Aaron, and Brian Rapp. Thank you all so much for being members of the Small Council. You are quite literally have paved the way for us to finish Lost, and it's great.
Pew! Oh, God, no, that wasn't the start. That was, I gotta clear my throat. And we're back for the storm. Yeah, we're into it. We're here for the pews.
The second last storm.
But yeah, I know. And I also feel
because there's not going to be a storm for the finale, I guess.
Oh my God, I just got really emotional.
It's the penultimate storm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Just take a minute and let that sink in. It's great.
So things I referenced that I would say in the storm that I have to circle back on. Neil, his body gets transported out, so when Jack passes out in the light and gets transported out to the exact same spot, we don't fucking worry about it.
It's done. Oh, right.
And so when Locke dies and he leaves a body, we're like, oh, all right, I guess the smoke monster leave lots of bodies. It kind of doesn't make any sense.
Sure, sure. You would think like transference of energy and matter would be like if a smoke monster is created, clearly they had to use the matter from the body. But, you know, it's an island of mystery. What are you going to do?
Non-corporeal. Yeah.
But then I was looking up like some stuff about this episode to try to make it make sense in the full Lost context. And there's also like when Desmond and Locke were previously exposed to the light when the Swan blew up, they also were like maybe transported and not actually blown out of the hatch, you know, because like access to the light can move you minorly in space-time on the island.
Well, and then, you know, spinning the donkey wheel, I guess that also sort of explains that, where it's like, if, as we now know, you're that close to the energy and you spin the wheel, it shoots you to another point on Earth, you know?
Right.
So,
and that's like the weaponized version of being exposed to the
light. Yeah, see,
like,
these are the fun answers.
By the way. He's like, I think I'll turn this wheel and then I'll leave. She's like, how do you know that? And we're all like sitting at home being like, well, he's right, actually.
Yeah, mm-hmm. he knows.
That's wild.
Those ancient engineers were better than the Dharma Initiative.
Maybe if I just spin this wheel near this weird glowy light, I'll leave the island. Yeah, that makes sense, right?
What we needed from this episode was more time spent with Titus Welliver and the other people and to learn that one of the people that was in that camp was a time-traveling Dan Faraday. Like Time Daddy himself came back and
Time
told them
Daddy.
Where to put the donkey.
At the beginning.
Show me how.
But it's also, like maybe a wheel.
Or maybe give him maybe it's too close to Averno, but like give him a love story. Mm-hmm. Like humanize him even more. Like I would have spent an entire episode with him at the camp. Like, I don't know. Interesting. I want more, not less, of Across the Sea, I think is the problem. Less mm-hmm. Alice and Janney, more Titus Welliver.
Switch out all of the temple for 4 episodes of Across the Sea.
I like this idea of it, like, it should have been a cold open every episode of the season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or and like just a Breaking Bad season 2, piecing it all together.
Or like, what are we watching? And you get so excited every week, you get just another little morsel of it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Baby Jacob? Oh, fun. And then I think the pacing could have been better, too.
Yeah, it certainly would have helped people follow along with the fact that Kid Jacob keeps showing up to Flock on the island.
Yeah, that would have been made more sense instead of
now it's like, oh, I know that kid. But
do you think... So he can see dead people. His mom and Jacob.
Mm-hmm. And Jacob and
Hurley,
can't.
And Hurley can see dead people. Like, do you think, like, true island leaders can see dead people?
Mm-hmm.
On the island, I think, yes, the island allows them to see dead people.
This because is why that's Richard, the only thing that Richard gets so excited that Ben sees his mom?
Yes. Mm. And why Richard... Oh, so then Richard would be able to see Isabella in theory. Oh, no, because she's not on the island. And well, no. She's not on the island.
But Richard's not a true island leader either. He's just a consultant.
Oh, that's true. And Hurley sees ghosts.
1099.
This would explain how Jack can see his dead father off the island. If it's like the true island leaders, the people who end up being the leader of the island, even though Jack's only island leader for like a day, can see dead people. That explains why his father was able to communicate with him. Like his actual ghost father.
He was able to actually
father.
See dead people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like a minor Hurley. That would frustrate Jack so much if he was like so close to opening his third eye and then
it doesn't quite explain what's going on with Miles. Maybe Miles was just like the best candidate from the 1970s that they had.
Well, but Miles doesn't see dead people. He like hears them.
He feels them.
Again, the ghost whisper, it's like the sickness. The varying flavors of ghost whispering will forever make me bonkers.
The other thing is, I think, like, there's enough period of time in history that the Romans and the Egyptians would have existed at the same time. This is actually pre any Egyptian structure on the island. What makes me think that, and what the internet sort of wants to do, is a very non-scientific method of when we see the light, when it's corked, it's not as bright shining out through the cave as it is here. And the idea being that the Man of Black wouldn't have been able to enter the light post-cork, and post-cork, that is Jacob's man-aided solution to letting that stop happening on accident.
Mm. So, like, Jacob contracted some Egyptians to make
the cork. Or the Man in Black did, and that's why there's hieroglyphs of the smoke monster appearing with Egyptian gods, and why there's the toilet summoner water portal that is also Egyptian in making and seems to like channel the water.
Well, I mean, we know that the Man in Black continued to work on this project because the donkey wheel was not finished when, you know, this whole thing went down with the mother. So yeah, I guess that makes sense.
And Jacob also just lives in an Egyptian statue at some point.
It's true. So at some point, Jacob summoned some Egyptian builders to the island, and they did a bunch of work for him.
They basically Jacob made a button, I guess is the better way to put it, in the island has repeated trauma lore. Is like, he accidentally made his brother a smoke monster, he really regretted it, so much like the Darby Initiative had like figured out a way to partially control the island from going like nuclear, he like got this all corked up. Light can still get out, because it's light. Not something could be corked up necessarily, but the water is maybe like separated from it or diverted in very specific directions instead of being free flowing. I don't know.
And if someone doesn't come along every 108 minutes and check on the cork.
That's right.
Something I will say that I do like in this episode is that it lays the track for like watching Jack and then Hurley do the ritual. Mm-hmm. And I like how it gets like progressively... Don't the drinking vessels get progressively dumber? Like, I think Jack, it's like a tin cup, and then Hurley, it's like an Ajira plastic
water bottle
or something like that. You know what I mean? And I kind of like that.
The thing that works in this episode in this episode's favor in hindsight is at the end of Lost, I'm much better with just the answer that like there aren't any rules, there are intentions. Like, and by those intentions, you accidentally make rules. Like, you have to drink the water to become the protector, but the whole idea is you need to intentionally pass it on to somebody has been made into like this drinking ritual because like the vessel doesn't matter, like Joanna's mentioning. And so it feels much better to me and much more connected to the rest of the series if these are gods acting on intention. It's not necessarily like, you know, when the cork's out, he's vulnerable. When the cork's in, he's not vulnerable. You know, like that sort of thing. Yeah.
Well, and I think it it helps sort of smooth over some of the questions, or at least it seems intended to help, if all of the island's rules are just like whoever was in charge at the time, whatever they sort of thought was the rule, ultimately just becomes the rule because they're so powerful, right? So, like, the idea of the mother being able to make it so that Jacob and his brother can't kill each other, it only exists because she was in charge and had the power, and she just decided that that's what it was.
But it makes so much sense to me that Jacob is like, well, mommy said.
Right. Right.
Yeah. We're not allowed to hurt each other. So
Jacob's inability to get over his mother is what really fuels a lot of his shitty reign as Island God.
Oh, Jake.
The parents, they're the real villains of yeah. Lost.
The whole theme of Lost is parents will fuck you up, man.
All right, how are we doing on Storm? Do we have any content that we need to squeeze in here?
And we're running a little long. Let me see if there's a couple emails I want to hit. I think all of these can probably hold, actually. So sorry, this is a short little penultimate Storm, but like, I don't know what else. I mean, what else do we need to talk about?
I feel like all of the storms up to now have had a part of Across the Sea in them. So
yeah,
we've really covered this ground.
Is there anything you didn't remember from this episode, Dave, that you're like, oh, yeah?
Is there anything I didn't remember from this episode? I didn't remember them accidentally running across the other people. I thought at some point the mom showed them as, like, and they're dangerous. Like, you know, look who... For some reason, I had it in, like, look at these invaders, basically, in my mind. But I'd forgotten that they were out hunting boars and come across them in a boar hunt. But I don't remember, I didn't forget any of the important things.
Sure. I feel Alice like I forgot.
Yeah,
I feel like I forgot the donkey wheel part. That the donkey wheel's actually there.
When he spin this wheel.
I remember, you know, the conversation. I remember that like the mother injures him, and that sort of, you know, sets off the climax of this episode. But I forgot that it's just sitting there. The old wheel.
We no idea how what it's spinning or like sure. Any sort of, you know, how it makes contact with light, but not important. It works out.
How does it relieve the pressure that the light is giving off?
Who knows, Neil? It's a mystery and will be forever.
That was an answer lost. That they felt we don't need to go down that road. Like, we don't need to explain the mechanics of how this light actually works. We just need you to know that it's there and that's why the donkey wheel works later in time.
Speaking of answering questions, it seems like next week's episode title is sort of an aggressive answer for a question that we've like been inferring we have. Neil, where are we going next week?
We are going to find out what they died for, which is, you know, probably a week too late to be exploring, you know, what everybody just died for. But it's a little bit bigger than that, as we know. So this is an interesting one, because as I was saying before we started recording, this is the episode of season 6 that I don't feel like I remember anything from. Because so whether that is an element or an example of how insignificant some of this stuff is, we'll see. We'll see if that's the case. But this is the one where I'm just like, Abiturno, or I'm sorry, Across the Sea just sort of is like a black hole. And it just sort of sucks up all the energy around it. And we are about to find out what they died for.
Yep. Everybody, you know, sometimes forgets the penultimate episode, especially when it's sandwiched between Across the Sea and a 2.5-hour finale. Mm-hmm. Well, it was 2.5 hours when it aired on television. I'm sure it's a little bit shorter when we watch it. Maybe not that much shorter. But anyway, figure out, you know, with the ongoing continuing Lost podcasts, until then, where could people find more of your work? On the internet. Let's start this week with Joanna Robinson.
You can find me on vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. And like I said, I'll be watching some Marvel movies with Kristen Russo over in the feels like the first time Slack.
And Mr. Neil Miller.
Well, you know, you can always get me over at filmschoolrejects.com or on Twitter at Rejects or at One Perfect Shot. And don't forget to follow at Storm Podcast to get this week's Kistery poll, which I'm already dreading having to try and figure out.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You could follow me on Twitter at DA7E. You could also listen to me on the Fighting in the War Room podcast if you want to hear me talk about different pop culture. And here at the end of the show, with a list of just good advice, you're going to be putting on sunscreen, you're going to be not falling down because it's dangerous, and don't get involved in old white men's posthumous bullshit.